Chapter 4 The Dark Gatekeepers of the Astral Planes. Nick and Melissa sat looking at each other across the dinner table of the hotel restaurant. It was late and only a few people still sat sipping their last coffees. The light was low and candles burned at the center of the tables. Both were exhausted, but neither of them could sleep. It wasn't any wonder considering the events of the last 24 hours. Nick's mind was racing as he spoke to his wife. "Listen, Melissa, we have to go over the facts. Let's think about the properties of the sacred white powder. By doing that, we might get some idea of what is going on here." "Nick," Melissa searched his eyes, "are we really going to believe what Ali Mehmet and Noah are saying? Don't you think it's all crazy stuff?" "We say it's crazy because we don't understand it, but it doesn't make it untrue. The way I see it, we have to make a choice about what we believe. You're sitting there, not knowing which way to go. Do we believe in the way that we always have, or do we try to think another way? Lara has experienced a different life to us, a life in which outlandish things happen. I mean, she talks to an Australian Aboriginal woman, who also happens to know Ali Mehmet. Sister Abigail tells Lara the same things that she told Ali Mehmet. Really, we can't ignore things like that, can we? And we've had experience of all the things that Lara has told us in the past. Her dreams, her predictions, her warnings. We didn't ever listen to her, but we were always surprised when the things she said turned out to be true." "Yes," Melissa said sadly, "and we just brushed them away saying they were coincidences." "Coincidences indeed. How many coincidences do we need to see the truth? The truth that our daughter is special, that she understands life better than we do."
"Right," Nick exclaimed, somewhat surprised by Melissa's words. He could see she was trying hard to change her point of view.
"You see, Melissa, right now, there's stuff going on under our noses that we cannot see because we don't think along those lines. If we do start thinking in a crazy way, then we will see what's going on."
"That's right,"
Melissa cried. "How many times do people say that human beings only see what they want to see? If we only opened our minds and saw things in every way possible, instead of thinking that only our way counted, we wouldn't miss a thing. So, Melissa, we are going to make a decision here and now. We are not going to look back once we have made it. We choose to believe or not. At some point in everyone's life, they have to make a choice like this. We cannot be in two minds, otherwise we will not find our daughter. Will it be our usual way of thinking, or are we going to open our minds to new possibilities? If we decide on the new path, then we cannot go around thinking everyone mad. I want to open my mind. I just want my daughter back. I feel that in order to find her, I have to think like her."
"Good.
I'm with you on this whole thing. Now we haven't got time to ponder. Let's get to this business of the sacred white powder. What's so special about it? Let's think magical. Let's pretend we are the ancient priests. How would we use it, Melissa? And why?" Melissa and Nick huddled over the table, talking and opening their minds to the new adventure ahead. Now they felt hope, now they felt joy. They knew it was in their power to find their daughter. Before they did that, though, they had to look for all the hidden clues as to what this journey was about and what they had to do to rescue her. The following morning, Nick and Ali Mehmet were in the subterranean chamber of the pyramid. They hadn't got any official papers to get in. If they had asked for permission, Abdul Bakr would have insisted on coming with them. He'd have wanted to know what they were looking for, and would have snooped around after them. Ali Mehmet and Nick had simply used their position to get past the guards. Everyone knew Lara was missing. They were familiar with Nick and were friends with Ali Mehmet. Nick showed Ali Mehmet where he had found the sacred white powder. The pile of rubble still sat in heaps around the chamber. In the center of the poorly lit room was a hollowed-out hole in the ground, around which was placed a railing to stop any visitors from falling through. The pit fell to a ledge about 10 feet down, and from the ledge ran a horizontal tunnel that met with a wall of rock. It looked as if this rather long, very narrow tunnel led nowhere, which was strange, because who would dig out a tunnel through solid rock if it didn't lead to any place? If a person climbed down past the ledge,
The pit continued downwards for a further 50 feet. Nick's team had created the ledge by digging from the 10-foot mark further into the ground. Nick believed that there existed underground tunnels and chambers, but hadn't been able to get to them. Once, many years before, another archaeologist had dug in the same place, but had had as little success as Nick. Lots of good scientists had brought in special machines that could tell them whether there were any tunnels in the ground. Most of the machines had shown that there were corridors running in every possible direction. Getting to these tunnels was the problem. The underground world that a lot of people knew to exist just couldn't be found. But why? Why were they hidden? Who had gone through so much trouble to hide them? Why were so many tunnels in the whole of the pyramid so narrow, and why did a lot of them end up in front of a great wall of rock? Nick climbed over the rubble that had been created by the digging to the spot where the sacred white powder had been discovered. Ali Mehmet pondered. So it appeared there. From another place. From another dimension? Yes, dimension. It come from there. Let me sit. Ali Mehmet moved to where Nick stood and sat on the pile of rocks, adjusted his bottom to get comfortable and closed his eyes. What are you doing, Ali Mehmet? Nick asked. SSHHI using this, he pointed to the middle of his forehead. Ali Mehmet sat quietly, trying to clear his mind. When his racing thoughts slowed down and he felt more peaceful, he looked around the chamber without opening his eyes. He was using his third eye, the invisible eye in the center of the forehead. This, Sister Abigail had taught him, was the center of the imagination. The imagination was the eye that saw everything. Not only was it the eye, but the ears and the touch and the taste and the smell. Using the imagination to see beyond the physical things around us helped us to understand more, to experience further adventures than this world would allow. Ali Mehmet looked around and asked a question in his mind: what is here? What is here beyond what I see with my physical eyes? Where did the powder come from? Where is Lara? He relaxed until his mind began to allow pictures to form. The walls around him began to change. They seemed to brighten up, though the colors weren't different. Everything seemed to come alive. Usually this place was like a rock tomb, a kind of hollowed-out grave that was gray and lifeless. Now, the aliveness of the walls seemed to bring light to the basement. He could see better. In his mind, he looked all around him. The great thing about using the imagination was that you didn't have to turn your body. You could just see everything everywhere. All you had to do was decide where you wanted to look and your mind went there. He searched the walls and turned his mind to the direction where Nick was standing. Nick had moved to the center of the room and was leaning against the railings that surrounded the hole in the floor. He could see and feel Nick in his mind's eye. Suddenly though, Nick disappeared and a flight of stairs materialized. They seemed to spiral upwards. At the foot of the stairs, where the hole had been, was another set of steps leading downwards. These steps were neatly carved out of the rock and they descended deep into the ground. Light escaped from the depths, like a glow. Ali Mehmet moved his mind to peer into the stairwell going into the ground. He approached slowly, slowly, then suddenly a large dark figure leapt out and stood crouched before Ali Mehmet, who let out a scream so loud, it made Nick jump up from the railings and trip over some rocks. Ali Mehmet opened his eyes sharply. "Hoh!" he cried. "The dark gatekeepers. They guard the gateways. They don't let us pass." Nick brushed off the dust from his already grubby jeans. He was sitting on the mound of stones onto which he'd fallen. "What, Ali Mehmet? What did you see?" "The masters before tell me about the dark gatekeepers. They don't let us pass. They hear. They see me. They know now, we're going to come. Maybe they kill us." "Who are they, the dark gatekeepers, Ali Mehmet? What are you talking about?" In the dim, almost greenish light, Ali Mehmet's face looked wild. His eyes darted everywhere, and his breathing was noisy. "Ali Mehmet, calm down. Take a deep breath. Hold it. Breathe out. Again. Slow down, calm down, that's better." Nick had climbed over to Ali Mehmet and had placed his hand on his back. The old man calmed down and breathed more easily. "The dark gatekeepers, Ali Mehmet said slowly, they keep everybody here. They don't let us pass.
Don't let who pass?
You and me?
Not anybody.
No human being. We're trapped here. This world we don't leave. When we die, we come back here. Over and over, because they don't let us leave.
Who are the dark gatekeepers, Ali Mehmet?
Nick was trying to make sense out of the old man's broken English.
They are the demons.
They keep the souls here in the world.
When we die, we have no body, we are only soul.
Your soul is you, Nick, but with no body.
Maybe I feel you here, but I not see you with eyes.
When we die, we must go back to where we come from, but the demon not let us.
But why?
Why keep human souls here?
What good would that do?
Power.
They use the human being for power.
We are slave.
We do anything they want.
But they don't let us know we slave, so we don't fight them.
Nick slumped back against all the rocks and closed his eyes.
Phew.
This was getting to be an adventure of sorts he'd chosen to believe, and now he must remember to do so.
He couldn't label Ali Mehmet a foolish old man now, just because the story was, well, almost incredible.
So what did you see, Ali Mehmet?
Nick had to try to figure out what was going on so he could work out their next move.
The old man described his vision in graphic detail.
Why you not look yourself?
Ali Mehmet asked Nick.
Nick looked back at his friend inquisitively.
Me? I don't know how to see things like that. Everybody see things like this.
Just imagine.
Close your eyes.
Go on.
Close.
Nick closed his eyes.
On Ali Mehmet's instructions, he relaxed his mind and went as quiet inside as he possibly could, breathing deeply and softly.
Then, with his eyes closed, Nick used his imaginary eyes to see into the space around him.
He relaxed again and formed questions. Where did the white powder come from?
Who are the dark gatekeepers?
He allowed images to form in his mind.
The room grew brighter, the walls were lit up somehow, or were they just bright?
An image flashed in front of him, a dark-haired man in a white tunic, White Brotherhood. The name sounded in Nick's ears. The man was holding his hands together. He had the sacred white powder in this hand's take it. Nick suddenly, the image of the man was gone. Nick looked around the room to the center. The railings were gone and a spiral staircase stood in its place. It wound up far above Nick's head. In fact, where was the ceiling?
It was at least 100 or so feet up.
The spiral staircase turned upwards. Where it led, Nick had no idea. He could follow it with his mind. Instantly, Nick was at the top of the stairwell looking up into a great hall.
No, it was, wow,
the pyramid.
But he could only see the four sloping walls they met at the apex.
Right above where he stood now, there were no rooms, no tunnels at all inside this whole floor. It was light in here, not dark and dingy like before. Rays of sunlight were coming in through the windows.
Windows? Not windows, shafts.
He recognized them as shafts.
Narrow passageways and the solid heavy brickwork of the walls, allowing light into the building.
Light entered the various shafts at exact angles, forming a shape, a dodecahedron.
It was perfect geometry.
Suddenly, Nick saw a shadow. No, not one shadow, two, three, four. They moved from all four corners of the vast building. They'd seen him and moved quickly. He watched for a moment as they advanced. They stopped. They were shaped like two-legged hounds. They were dark shadowed creatures whose eyes glowed in order to see him more clearly. They watched carefully as they crept closer. Nick held still, watching them equally as closely. He could feel something, a sucking sensation. He was being sucked towards them. Nick took a breath and opened his eyes. He was on the floor of the subterranean chamber with Ali Mehmet staring at him wide-eyed.
You see them?
Nick was speechless for a moment.
Then he spoke. Ali Mehmet, was that real?
Didn't I just imagine that experience?
You imagine, yes.
And it real.
Very real.
Imagination is real.
Now you see all things that you want.
Your body eyes stop you from seeing everything.
The body eyes only for this world.
The imagination is for you to see any world.
The imagination is the true eye.
Well then, I saw them, Nick declared, in all their glory. He described his experience to Ali Mehmet.
Who was the man in the white tunic, White Brotherhood? These people all help us. They come to help us with the prophecy. The Bush Lady Abigail, the Masters. They tell me all things from a child. I travel with a lady. She old. Older than this world. They all teach me. They tell me time will come I must tell people. I must help the people who get into trouble with the dark gatekeepers. Now the time is here. I didn't know the persons as you, Nick. I didn't know the persons as Lara and Noah and Melissa. I am happy the people is all of you, because you are my friends. You are my family. Ali Mehmet's eyes welled up with tears, and he hugs the close friend sitting beside him. We're glad we've got you, Ali Mehmet. Nick said sentimentally. Without your guidance, I don't know what we'd do. You and Lara, you're the same. You think the same. You have the same experiences. Only you can help us. Then we find her. We must find a way to meet her. We must find her with the imagination. Any other way, we find nobody. On the plush carpeted floor of their hotel suite, Melissa fumbled through the pages containing the translations of the scrolls. Noah, seated across from her on a pile of satin cushions, watched as his mother looked for some passages about the sacred white powder. The hospital had let him go home early this morning as they couldn't find anything wrong with him. He was glad to get out of the way of that pesky Abdul Bakr fellow. The man had poked his head around the door of the hospital room practically every hour on the hour, pretending to be concerned, asking if Noah was okay, and if he remembered anything about the disappearance of his sister. Noah had tried to sleep, but had given up all hope of that bald-headed nuisance leaving him in peace. Abdul Bakr had looked quite pleased with himself when Noah had insisted that he couldn't remember a thing. Mum was on board with this crazy escapade, Noah was pleased to learn. He was surprised by her energy. She was really going for it with all guns blazing. She looked up at Noah, who had been distracted by an interesting-looking glassy object lying near her. What's that? He asked, crawling over to pick it up. It's Lara's, Melissa answered sadly. I went to search her bags hoping to find some clues. You know your sister, she's always got something up her sleeve. Well, I found this. It's her crystal, don't you remember? She called it the dreaming crystal that Sister Abigail gave her. I remember now. That was ages ago. We didn't believe her. You were convinced that someone at school had given it to her and that she was dramatizing. Yes, well, Melissa looked down. Things are different now. I fished it out of her bag. She obviously brought it with her for some reason. Noah held the dreaming crystal in his hands. It was a large 12-sided clear quartz crystal, which looked like it was made of glass. It felt warm to the touch as Noah turned it slowly in his hands, peering into it at all angles. The dreaming crystal absorbed and reflected the light, rainbow colors bounced from it, and Noah felt a strange tingling in the middle of his forehead. Then, something caught his eye, a movement in the center of figure. Was there a figure in the crystal? He blinked and the figure was gone. Noah put the crystal down. He looked at it again. The figure she had looked familiar. She? His mother's voice broke through his almost hypnotized state. He turned to her. These are the translations of the ancient documents found in those jars next to the sacred white powder that Dad found. I must confess I just skimmed over some of it. I didn't think stuff like this could be true. Melissa shuffled the papers in her hands, trying to put them in order. But it all makes sense with what's going on, Noah answered in a small voice. He still felt a bit funny around the head region. That crystal, was it doing something? I know Egyptologists think that the ancient stories of gods and high priests are mythical, the stuff of fairy tales. Why should it be mythical? Why? Because people don't understand it. I'm beginning to realize now that historians and Egyptologists are not really as clever as they think they are. People find wonderful artifacts and ancient buildings, but they never, ever find real information about what they were used for, so everybody guesses at everything and then write what they think in history books as if what they were saying was true. I should know, I am married to an Egyptologist who complains about this all the time. So? So what do the notes say about the sacred white powder? He had better keep Mum on track, otherwise she'd lecture on and on for hours about the weaknesses of Egyptologists. Oh, yes, I'll read bits and pieces out to you. The powder was made by a group of alchemists who called themselves the White Brotherhood. They also went by the name the Order of the Dove. Nobody else had the ability to make the powder because its quality was too high for the earthly world. The Brotherhood didn't make it here because they didn't exist here. They made it and delivered it to the high priests of the temples of Egypt. They delivered the goods by way of the great doorway and by using the music of the universe to pass through. Melissa looked up with widened eyes at Noah, who had leaned forward listening intently. Hadn't Ali Mehmet said something about music making people change dimensions? Noah had heard the hum. She went back to the text. The high priests ruled Egypt. They ruled along with the pharaohs of that time. The pharaohs were called Horus kings. They were the sons of Osiris. The high priests of Egypt worked closely with the White Brotherhood. The high priests taught students of the temple about using power. People in the human world are trapped in this dimension. When they die, they go to a place called the astral. They roam around the astral, lost. Then they come back to the earth again through human women who get pregnant. They live again, then die again, and keep coming back over and over again because all the doorways to the heavens are closed off. They are closed off by people who rule this earth. These are people that humans do not know about. They use the dark gatekeepers to guard the heavenly doorways. The job of the priests was to teach students how to get through the doorways to the heavens, past the dark gatekeepers to teach them these things. The students had to practice. They used the sacred white powder to travel to the astral and roam its corridors while they were still in their human bodies. The White Brotherhood were also gatekeepers of the same portals. The students were tested at the portals by the White Brotherhood, and if they passed the test, they would be allowed through. They could leave for the heavens in their bodies, or they could return to the earth and leave the astral when they died. If they failed their tests, they were taken by the dark gatekeepers and kept prisoner in lower dimensions until they found the power to escape. Melissa rubbed her eyes. This was a lot to take in, a lot for her usually skeptical mind. She had never believed anything like this before, but now she'd made a promise to herself. This was the world that her daughter understood, and she would try to understand it too. She looked down at the crystal lying next to Noah and leaned over to pick it up. She needed some comfort that she was doing the right thing. She hoped that she wasn't on some wild goose chase. The hand holding the crystal suddenly felt hot. She looked down at it. Faint electrical currents ran through her hands. She peered into the clear quartz. There was a woman. It was Sister Abigail. Melissa let out a loud squeal and dropped the crystal. Noah jumped up and backed away when he saw his mother's face. "What? What?" Noah shouted. "Oh my goodness. It's her. It's Sister Abigail." Melissa's eyes darted about as the memories came flooding back, but, it couldn't be. Yes, it was true. Sister Abigail had visited her too. When she was very young. She remembered now. How could she have forgotten? Noah's eyes nearly popped out of his head at his mother's words. That was it. It was her. Sister Abigail. She used to visit him and take him to some great places. They'd had such fun, but then he'd forgotten. How had that happened? Suddenly, there was a piercing ringing sound. Both Melissa and Noah cupped their hands over their ears as it rose in pitch and then fell. It evened out to a low drone. Then they heard her voice, at last. "You remember your old friend?" Sister Abigail's voice was so familiar now to Melissa and Noah, it felt as if they'd never left her side. "Take the crystal. Both of you. Take the crystal and hold it in your hands together." Melissa and Noah were both stunned. They had so many questions they had to ask Sister Abigail. Melissa grabbed the crystal from the floor and held it up on the palm of her hand. Noah placed his hand around the base of the crystal. "Rest your arms on something, Melissa. This might take a while." Melissa rested her lower arms onto a nearby coffee table. She and Noah waited. A beam of light shot out from the crystal and another more beams traveled from the crystalline center into the middle of the large room. Pictures began to form. They were holograms, moving pictures created out of light. Noah and Melissa gazed at what looked like a 3D movie in front of them. Slowly, the pictures of the movie expanded. The hologram grew until Noah and Melissa found themselves sitting in the familiar surroundings of Sister Abigail's native Australia, and there she was. The same old friend they had abandoned so long ago. "Let's talk," she said, her hair bouncing as she laughed at their wonderment about the properties of the sacred white powder, the sky people who came and changed their DNA. And most importantly, and Lara? Melissa interrupted quickly. Of course, but first I must tell you about the keys of Amenti, which will help you to find her. Later, after Sister Abigail had gone, and Melissa had placed the dreaming crystal on a table, Nick and Ali Mehmet burst in the room. They both looked wild-eyed and excited. Melissa! Noah! Nick shouted, have we got news for you? Melissa looked at Noah and back at the two men. You too? She smiled. They sat for a long time, sharing the important information that would help them on their journey. Chapter 5: The Children of Rainbow's End. Lara stood by the Rainbow Bridge and listened as Lady Madonna spoke. A group of children about Lara's age and a little older flocked around, looking at her, amused and fascinated. Some of them had tried to touch her and their hands had felt like the lightest feathers brushing up against her skin. They'd giggled and laughed. All of them jostled for a place to see her more clearly. Don't mind them, the lady had laughed, you're a treat, a real novelty. They've never seen anything like you here before. Lara held out her hand and some of the children reached out to touch her again. They gasped, this strange girl was so solid. Who are they, Lady Madonna? Why are they here? Lara sort of knew the answer, but wanted a better explanation than the one Seth's man had given her. They are the children of humanity, these are the children left behind when people become adults. Why are they so light, so transparent? Lara had seen that some of the children were more transparent than others. Because they don't have a body to live in, their bodies have become adult and there is no room for their child spirit in adult bodies. Oh! Lara exclaimed, I think I understand. The man who brought me here did explain, but I don't get all of it. I know, my dear, the lady sympathized, it is very difficult for you. Think of it this way. Children and adults are very different, aren't they? They think differently, am I right? Did you notice? The lady was smiling. Lara nodded in agreement. Children are not afraid of anything. Children climb trees, they take exciting risks, they make friends without any worries, they laugh easily, they love everyone and forgive anything. When people start to become adults, this way of thinking leaves them. As adults, they start being afraid of the world. They worry about things going wrong and so they stop having adventures in life. They work too hard and stop having fun. They get cross with each other quickly and only love people if they get something back. How is it that you are here, Lady Madonna? I am one of many caretakers of children. We are known as the Angels of Peace. Do you know what peace means, Lara? Peace means to be whole, to feel completely free, sort of to be an adult and a child both at the same time. Does that mean the children are lost here? Can't they ever go back to their bodies? Only if adults want them to. The child spirit is the part of us that loves life so much we see all the energy, all the colors, all the fun, all the prettiness, all the strange and wonderful ideas. We love everything because our hearts burst with the beauty of everything. But adults choose to be afraid. They look for the dark side of everything. To an adult, there is always danger lurking around a corner. You will have noticed that some children are more transparent than others. These children have grown into adults who are more playful, more trusting, less serious than others. They are transparent because they are partly in their adult bodies. Lara turned from the lady, and her thoughts went to her mother. Now she was a serious one, with her scientific outlook, always afraid, always looking for Lara's eyes suddenly lit up. She turned back to Lady Madonna excitedly. Is my mother here? My father? Of course, the lady smiled, but they won't recognize you as their daughter, though they'll understand that you are connected. Nick. Melissa. Lara stood open-mouthed as Nick and Melissa stepped forward from behind the crowd of children, holding hands. They must be about 12 years old. They giggled as they looked at her. She recognized them from photographs her parents had shown her. Lara felt dizzy. This was such a strange meeting. She stepped forward, she felt their energy. They were definitely her parents in a way, They did feel different. They were kids after all. She reached out to touch them. They laughed and touched her back. The two of them held hands tightly and looked lovingly at each other. Yes, Lara remembered, now, they had been childhood sweethearts. Her father was more transparent than her mother, but that made sense to Lara. Suddenly, from beyond the crowd, pushed a little boy. Lara recognized him, but only just. He was almost ghost-like, not really formed. It was Noah. The boy smiled mischievously. It was definitely Noah. But what was he doing here? Noah's leaving childhood, the lady smiled a little sadly, but he's taking his time. He is struggling in the way all teenagers do at first. Giving up trust and joy is difficult for the human body. Eventually, his form will be stronger. The children are always this transparent when they first get here. The lady pointed to the bridge she had brought Lara to see. Lara, though finding it difficult to take her eyes off her family members, turned to look in the direction the lady was facing. It was the Rainbow Bridge, the bridge that led back to the dimension that Lara had come from. It was a beautiful structure, made from silver metal and inlaid with precious colorful stones of the earth. The walkway was paved with shiny cobblestones that had not been walked upon since it was built. This is the bridge that leads out of here, but the portal at the end of the crossing only allows the passing through of child spirits. The children arrive through that portal. It is a gateway from, and into, the human soul. They rarely go back through, unless their adult selves become whole and accept their child selves back. Sadly, though, the truth is the children of the human world are trapped here. What happens to the children, then? They just stay here forever. The people from the skies feed from them, the people from the skies, yes. The masters had told her about them and she'd met them. The sky people were the custodians they'd brought her here. But feed from them? What do you mean feed, Lady Madonna? Lara asked horrified. The people from the skies use the energy of these children to prolong their lives. They take children from here and place them in their laboratories. The children's spirits are absorbed into the DNA of the sky people. Lara sat down. She was shocked. She looked up at the lady. Why are you telling me all this, Lady Madonna? I think you know, don't you? This is part of your test as a Horus Tasker. You have to have this knowledge so that you can use it to win your battle. You know all about that? Lara asked. Of course, the lady replied, you are here as part of a test to see if you can win back your power. We have all been informed. Lara was intrigued and gladdened by this news. She moved closer to the lady. I'll get out of here, won't I, Lady Madonna? I don't know, Lara, the lady replied, looking at her closely. I don't know. It's up to you. You are a Horus Tasker, and every once in a while people like you pass by this place. Do they all get out? Lara held her breath to hear the answer. Not all, Lara. Not all find their strength, not all find their true power. What happened to those who failed, then? Lara asked fearfully. Her eyes did not leave the lady's. The dark gatekeepers came and took them away. Lara's voice was small, now. And where did the dark gatekeepers take them? To the Ashen Forest. In that dark place, their spirits are captured by evil beings. Only in finding their power can they ever get out. None that I know of have ever escaped. Couldn't you have helped them, Lady Madonna? We cannot interfere with your chosen experience, the lady replied. This is your test, your job as a Horus Tasker. All we can do as angels of peace is take care of the children while the adults continue to choose being afraid. We can't change the choices of any human being, but we can love them the best we can. We have to stand by and watch the sky people take away the children to their laboratories. We can do nothing because that would be interfering with the choices of human beings. You volunteered for this mission to find power. If you pass this test, others will learn from your adventure and you can then tell people what is happening to them and teach them how to use their own power. If you don't pass, nobody will learn anything. It is in your hands. Lara looked at the Rainbow Bridge. Her heart felt cold at the thought of the Ashen Forest. She knew now that she couldn't rest too long with the Lady Madonna. She couldn't hide in this children's world even if she'd wanted to. The dark gatekeepers would come for her. She didn't know who they were yet, but the lady would tell her. She had a task to perform and she'd better start doing something quickly. She looked at the rainbow bridge to the portal. She had to get out of here. She glanced around her. The little boy with the mischievous smile was grinning at her. Noah, she thought suddenly Noah would help her to get out of here. But she'd have to find a way to make contact with him. Where is it? Where? Confound it. Why haven't you found the powder? Rainford can't keep it hidden for long. The last thing we need is for him to take it and get the prophecy in motion. We've got the kid hidden. It's over. Over, do you hear? Seth ranted on as usual, spitting as he yelled at the top of his lungs, with the custodians listening on, waiting for him to see some sort of reason. The chief aide gave a heavy sigh, hoping his raging boss wouldn't notice. He didn't fancy turning into Green Goo right now. Green Goo? That Rainford girl had got them started on that one. He didn't fancy switching, if you please. Why wouldn't Rainford be able to hide the powder? It's not as if the aides were sniffer dogs now, right? They knew how to sniff things out that had potent smells, but this sacred white powder didn't smell of anything. Mr. Furious up there knew that much. The aides had looked everywhere. They'd had Abdul Bakr on the case for the last 24 hours and he couldn't find a thing. His team had searched the Rainfords' rooms while they were out, and still the powder was missing. At this point, they didn't want to alert Rainford that anything was wrong. As far as the man was concerned, his daughter had been kidnapped and gone forever, and the aides just hoped he'd get on a plane as soon as possible and get on home. Then, they'd be shot of this problem and their boss could stop ranting. They'd all get a bit of peace and quiet and a good night's sleep. Hopefully, they could look back on this episode and perhaps learn from it. They'd have to find out how the girl got in touch with the Masters in the first place. It was just mind-boggling, the whole thing. How did anyone get past their portals? It would be a good idea to ban these damned archaeologists from poking their noses around old sites like these. Let them go dig on the beaches or something and find old fossils and a few old shells. The chief aide looked up at his boss. Steam came out of Seth's ears and he kept on sipping his tonic in case he switched. Sometimes, he looked like a big bozo. The chief aide smiled smugly to himself. Yes, a big stupid bozo. Abdul Bakr was suspicious. Rainford and his old buddy had been to the pyramid this morning, and now they were going again? The wife and kid were going too, by the looks of things. Abdul Bakr's secret spy at the pyramid entrance had told him what was going on. Ali Mehmet had told the spy they were coming again, but hadn't mentioned what they were after. What were they up to? Were they just going to have yet another look for the girl? If they were, they wouldn't find anything. The boy couldn't remember what had happened to him and his sister. He'd had a gormless look on his face the whole time he'd been in the hospital, and he'd even looked like a brainless bug when Ali Bakr himself had gone to the hotel room to ask after his health. He called a couple of the aides and arranged to meet them at the Great Pyramid entrance within the hour. He'd give the family some time to get in there ahead of them and they'd follow them in and see what they were up to. The aides would pretend they were on a police mission to find the Rainford girl or something. Geez, Abdul Bakr just wished those damn Rainfords would go home. What pests this family were turning out to be. First, they had to put up with the too big for her boots daughter with all her knowledge and fancy master contacts. Well, that got her nowhere, didn't it? Now she was holed up in a place no one would ever find her. And most probably the dark gatekeepers would get hold of her and have her for lunch, and luckily, her family were pretty stupid. They wouldn't have a clue where she was. Not in a million years. The mother was one of those self-important skeptical scientists who were convinced that if something couldn't be seen, it didn't exist. Well, thank goodness for close-minded people like her. They'd keep everyone ignorant for at least another 1,000 or so years. And the father was a buffoon archaeologist like the rest of them who believed all the so-called official made-up stories about the pyramids and other old buildings. To think they gave them those silly university degrees in lies. What a laugh these humans were. They sat around with their noses in the air, all puffed up, smoking cigars and acting important as if. As for Ali Mehmet, well, that old fossil was as brainless as they came. Abdul Baker was feeling tired and bad-tempered with everyone. He rubbed his temples. He'd go down there to the pyramid just to put his mind at rest, and then he'd go to bed early. He desperately wanted some sleep, little did Abdul Baker know, but in the next 48 hours or so he was going to need it. The four of them stood in the subterranean chamber, surrounded by the rubble. Melissa had never liked this place. It gave her the creeps. It felt like an enormous rock coffin, a carved-out hole in which people were placed after they were dead. Melissa clasped the dreaming crystal in her hands. She looked over at Nick, who was unwrapping the package he had taken out of his shirt. He'd hidden it there, afraid that someone would find it and confiscate it. They couldn't take any chances at the moment. Nobody was sure who were the good guys or the bad guys. They weren't even sure anymore whether they could trust the police. Ali Mehmet had his eyes closed. He was trying to concentrate and quieten himself. He was afraid of the dark gatekeepers, and he needed to calm himself down before he tried to take them on. "What now, Dad?" Noah asked, looking bemusedly at the Buddha posed Ali Mehmet sitting on his heap of stones. "What now?" "Now, I'm going to sample this sacred white powder. We'll soon find out if it is what the scrolls and Sister Abigail, I might add, say it is. What is it made of?" In the hotel, it looked like tiny flakes of snow. Noah touched the brown package that Nick held in his hands. "It's a substance made from gold, apparently," Nick replied. "It is gold that is somehow taken right down to monatomic form." "What?" Noah asked, scrunching up his eyebrows questioningly. "It is monatomic gold. What that means is, it began life as a gold metal and was heated in many, many stages until it finally heated right down into single atoms. That means it is not really gold as we know it anymore, but is just what scientists call a monatomic form of gold. Human beings cannot take any kind of gold powder into their bodies because it is poisonous. This is not gold powder like you might think. It is something different entirely. Well, it's white for a start. What does it actually do? Well, you know that the body is made of organs like the heart and lungs and such. And the organs are made of cells, and the cells are made of molecules, and the molecules are made of atoms. Well, monatomic gold is supposed to take all the atoms of your body and make them move very quickly. So? What difference would that make? Noah asked. If I put my hand on your arm now, it feels firm to my touch. See? Nick placed his hand over Noah's upper arm. Now that's because your atoms and my atoms are moving at a certain speed that we both recognize. All the atoms that make up this physical world move at a certain speed, and we can touch, see, hear, smell and taste all of it. We can do this because the atoms of all these objects move at more or less the same speed. The sacred white powder, however, is supposed to make the atoms move even faster than they usually do. So, if I take this stuff and it speeds up the movement of my atoms, it would mean that the people in this world, or dimension, would no longer see me with their eyes. They would no longer hear me or sense me in any physical way. What? Then you'd disappear in a puff of smoke. Not quite. You wouldn't see me, and I probably wouldn't see you, but I would encounter a new world, or dimension altogether. My atoms would be moving at the same speed as people of that world, and I could have conversations with them or whatever. I'll find out sooner or later.
That's so cool.
Noah was very impressed with the sacred white powder. Can I take some too? Let's first see what happens with me. It's ancient, so it might not even work anymore. It's not ancient, Noah said. It was delivered to you by the White Brotherhood. And Sister Abigail insists that it works.
Maybe, Noah.
Maybe. I certainly hope the White Brotherhood thing is real, because that means someone is on our side in this whole mess. Nick took out a plastic water bottle that dangled from a thin chain around his neck. There was only a small amount of water in it, and he unscrewed the top, took out a plastic spoon from inside his shirt and scooped a large spoonful of the powder from a small opening in the brown wrapping. Nick carefully dropped the powder into the bottle and shook the container. Some of the extremely fine particles floated about on the air around Nick. He repeated the action 3 times and then drank the substance down in a couple of swallows. He refolded the package and handed it over to Noah. "Keep this on you in case anything does happen," Nick said. "Use your water bottle, the powder absorbs into the bloodstream far quicker when taken with water." Noah put the package in his shirt and secured it at the top of his trousers under his belt line. Melissa stared at Nick, while Noah poked at him to see if he was still physical to the touch. Ali Mehmet remained in the same position with his eyes closed, unaware of what was going on around him. "Give it a chance," Nick cried at Noah, who had his fingers dug far into his father's ribs. Noah sat down on the rocks beneath his feet, his eyes glued to Nick. If his father popped off leaving a smoky trail, he wanted to be the first to see it. Nothing happened though. They waited for what seemed like a long while. Eventually, Nick sat down, disappointed. The sound of voices and shuffling in the narrow tunnel that led to this chamber caused the three of them to turn their heads towards the entrance. They all looked at each other. Melissa glanced over at Ali Mehmet and realized he must be off somewhere on some dreamtime adventure, because he still did not stir from his position. The voices were loud since, to hear each other, the group whoever they were had to call over their shoulders. Crawling had to take place in a line, one person behind another because the tunnel was too narrow for anything else. The shuffling and the voices grew closer and closer. Noah listened carefully. The strangers were near to the entrance now. He thought he recognized one of the voices.
Of course.
It would be, wouldn't it? It was the creepy crawly pest of a man, King Tut. Abdul Baker was coming to check up on them. Noah looked at his mother, who had her eyes on the entrance, and then turned round to Nick. Noah's eyes darted around the chamber. Nick was gone. "He's gone," Noah managed to whisper loudly just as a head poked out of the tunnel into the chamber. Melissa gave a few startled glances around her, looked uneasily at Noah and brought her gaze back to the entrance. The men were climbing out and dusting themselves down. One was feeling about in his shirt pocket. He appeared to have lost something. He said something to the other, who tapped his own pocket reassuringly. Two of them stood before her now. Melissa recognized them from before. They were on various committees. She hadn't realized how small they were until now. They weren't midgets or anything. Some were of reasonable height, but their features were just small. They had small hands and protruding eyes, and they were wiry, not heavy-muscled. The men stepped forward and put their hands out for shaking. They wore big grins, a little too big. Noah thought they pretended to be surprised to see them here. Abdul Baker's bald head popped through the entrance, and it took all Noah's strength to stop himself from going straight over and poking him in his annoying bulgy eyes. There were now three of them. There didn't appear to be anyone else coming through the tunnel. "Hello there," Abdul Baker cried as he brushed down his trousers. "What a coincidence. Are you feeling good now, Noah? Do you remember anything?"
"No.
It's all a blank. We're here to trigger a memory or something, but it didn't work. I can't remember a thing." Noah watched Abdul Baker, whose popping eyes moved in all directions as he spoke. "Shame. But never mind. Where's Mr. Rainford?" "Oh," Melissa stepped in. He went up to the king's chamber. She looked over at Noah, who seemed far better at lying than she did. "Yeah, he went up there to see if there were any clues the police might have missed. He'll come down soon." "What's he doing?" Abdul Baker pointed to Ali Mehmet, who still hadn't moved. He sat with his legs crossed and his hands resting on his knees. Abdul Baker pushed his head forward and strained his neck to get a better look. "He's praying," Noah said. "Don't disturb him." "Praying? But he's a Muslim. Muslims don't pray like that." "No, but Lara was a Buddhist. He's respecting her beliefs." Noah looked over at his mother, who rolled up her eyes in disbelief. "Oh," Abdul Baker said, turning his body away from Ali Mehmet's direction, but trying to keep his eyes on the man. Noah wasn't sure that Abdul Baker was convinced with his explanation. "What are you doing here?" Melissa asked Abdul Baker. "Same as you were looking for clues as to who might have taken your daughter. If you say there's nothing here though, we might as well all leave. We want to lock up the Great Pyramid for the next couple of weeks. There's been too much going on. We don't want the public alarmed by any possible further incidences. We don't know if there are groups of kidnappers taking tourists or not. We'll find out after further investigations. We're lucky to have kept this quiet. We should go now. Melissa looked at Noah, who thought quickly. What could they do? They couldn't let them lock the place up. And what about Dad? This was getting to be a mess. And where the heck was Ali Mehmet? His body was here, but his mind had traveled off somewhere. Suddenly all heads turned in Ali Mehmet's direction. He was moaning, crying. He started yelling, "They know. They know. The dark gatekeepers know about Lara. They're going to fetch her. They will take her to Ashen Forest. She there. She there with the children. Rainbow, Rainbow, Noah. Speak to her." Abdul Bakr rushed at Ali Mehmet and the two other men followed. Abdul Bakr grabbed the old man by the shirt collar, pulled him to his feet and shook him. "Where have you been? What are you talking about? Talk, old man." Noah and Melissa stumbled over the rubble to Ali Mehmet's aid. "Leave him alone," Noah cried. "Don't you touch him." Abdul Bakr turned to Noah and Melissa, his eyes bulging. "Praying? You think I'm stupid? He's been traveling." Abdul Bakr started ranting and raving in some language that was certainly not Arabic. He looked from Noah to Melissa to Ali Mehmet while yelling stuff that nobody understood. Melissa stepped back in surprise as Abdul Bakr's face started going green and moving. He kept on ranting. He seemed to start collapsing. His body started shimmering and green waves of energy, like smoke, started coming from him. His face was falling apart as his mouth continued to move. He reached for his shirt pocket and grabbed for the tonic. Noah lurched at Abdul Bakr and knocked the tonic from his hands. It fell into the rubble. The other two men ran at them. One tripped over the pile of rocks and the other, grabbing at Abdul Bakr, reached into his own pocket. He looked down. Nothing was there. He had lost his tonic in the tunnel. He turned to the man who tripped and reached down for his pocket, but Noah took a leap and tumbled right down on both of them. In the tussle, the second man managed to throw the tonic clear. Abdul Bakr ran for it, grabbed it and made for the entrance to the narrow tunnel. He poured the stuff down his throat in great gulps, and as he sank to his knees, his body stabilized. It stopped moving and became solid again. He put his hands to the floor and crawled back through the tunnel. Ali Mehmet, meanwhile, grasped Melissa's shoulders. "Go," he shouted, "go to the Great Lion. Lara at Rainbow's End. Sister Abigail, tell me. You must go to the Great Lion and find the White Gatekeeper. Go now." "But what about Noah?" "I can't leave him." "He fine," the men finished. "Don't worry." Melissa looked down in horror at the newly forming green slime on the floor of the subterranean chamber. Abdul Bakr had taken off with the only remaining tonic. The two men left behind were now formless and luminescent. The green slime actually glowed in the dark like the gooey plasticine her children used to buy from toy shops. This horrible stuff, though, was even wetter and slimier. It slid off the pile of rubble and moved along the floor and up the walls. Her skin crawled at the sight. She looked over at Noah, who watched the whole scene with a look of disgusted fascination. Melissa, Ali Mehmet and Noah looked on as eventually the slimy green beings disappeared altogether. Ali Mehmet turned to Melissa, "You still here?" "There's no time." "But I don't understand, Ali Mehmet. What is the Great Lion and what do I do when I get there?" "We have to use this," Noah interrupted. He was looking tousled, with his hair standing up and dust smeared over his shirt and trousers. He held the package in his hands. "It worked for Dad. It'll work for us. But we don't even know what's happened to Dad. Shouldn't we wait for him to reappear before we go swallowing this stuff? Anything could have happened to him. Do we have time?" Noah asked his mother with exasperation. "Whoever's in charge of Abdul Bakr's lot are going to figure out something's wrong. You heard what Abdul Bakr said, he planned to close this place. They don't want us poking about. And now he's gone off for help, we're really going to be in trouble. But I'm worried. Melissa was deeply anxious. I don't know what move to make next. I don't know where Nick is. I don't know if I should leave you. No, I don't know what to. Melissa felt a surge of heat move up her arms. She looked down at her hands and found them still clutching at the dreaming crystal. In all the excitement, she'd quite forgotten about it. A light in the center of the crystal caught Melissa's eye. She looked up at the others and with one hand put a finger to her lips. Everything was quiet in the chamber. The light grew until it encircled the clear stone in Melissa's hands. It moved from the crystal to the center of the rocky cave, leaving a silver trail that ran into the crystal center. The light strengthened and expanded until it took up most of the space in the chamber. The three of them sat down to watch in awe. Nobody said a word. Back in the subterranean chamber, Nick had suddenly had a funny turn after thinking the sacred white powder wasn't going to work after all. He had started by feeling as if he had butterflies in his stomach, then he'd got a strange case of goosebumps that kept on raising on his skin, and waves after that, he'd begun to hear a sound, a humming in his body. It was a sound he was familiar with, yet he'd never heard it before. Wasn't that weird? He had also been able to hear voices, lots of them. People were talking in his ears, 19 to the dozen. Then the voices had disappeared. He'd looked around at his wife and son. They'd started shimmering. The walls of the room had started moving, becoming fainter. Everything had become brighter, more alive. Soon, the subterranean chamber had disappeared. The strangeness in his body had eased as the new surroundings came into view. His head still felt peculiar. His eyes felt a bit itchy, and his forehead felt tickly. He tried to scratch at it, but the sensation was inside his head. Nick found himself seated on a marble floor in the middle of a hall so huge that he couldn't even begin to imagine its measurements. The building was domed, and in the dead center, encased in clear crystal right under Nick's bottom, was a gigantic white dove of polished quartz. He stood up and felt dwarfed by the hall. It was quiet, peaceful. He waited, almost holding his breath. He began to hear music. The sound was all around, and within him the air seemed to glitter with gold sparks, as if someone had allowed gold fairy powder to fall from the ceiling. Then they appeared. They just were there, all around him, groups of men in white tunics and brown roped belts tied at their waists. They all had dark brown curly hair and brown skin, though they were of different shapes and sizes. All were bigger in size than Nick, who was quite tall by human standards, and they wore sandals. There was something so peaceful about these men, something so divine. Nick was speechless. He couldn't think of anything to say for himself. One of them spoke first. "Hello, Nick, we've been waiting for you. My name is Balthazar, and these are my brothers. We are known as the White Brotherhood, or the Order of the Dove. We welcome you." "The White Brotherhood, the Order of the Dove. The people who made the sacred white powder." So it was true. This being called Balthazar had a voice and face that was so gentle, so caring. It made Nick's heart want to burst just being in his presence. "Who are you exactly? I sort of I know of you." Nick was overwhelmed. He'd felt the same way on his first day at school many, many years before. "Of course you know of us. We sent you the great legacy. The White Brotherhood acts as a bridge between humans and Orions. The Orions are beings of knowledge and of great civilization. They have a form that is very different from yours, and so we speak on their behalf concerning spiritual, priestly matters. We have both Orion and human DNA, and exist on the borders of their dimension. We are known here as the High Priests of Orion. We pass down knowledge from these people to you." "Where are we?" "This is the Temple of Orion, Nick. It is also known as the Great Domed Hall. We are within the city of Heliopolis."
"The what?
But it can't be, can it?" "I suppose it must be." Nick was babbling. He thought he'd better keep quiet until he'd composed himself. "Heliopolis? The great, legendary city of Heliopolis?" It was so old, so ancient. Nick had studied the history of Heliopolis. It had been a great bustling city situated near to where Giza is now. It had been a place of great learning, and people had come from all over the world to study there. Great temples had been built at Heliopolis, and it had been written that the greatest, most magical teachings had been secret. Nobody ever found out what these teachings were about because everyone who took them was sworn to oaths of secrecy.
"Did I travel back in time?"
Nick asked. "No, Nick," Balthazar smiled. You traveled out of time.
Out of time? How is that?
Heliopolis never existed in time. This was never a place in your physical world. It belongs here in Orion. This is not a place where time passes.
We always are.
We do not move forwards or backwards. We do not exist in time like your world does.
We're in Orion?
Nick looked around the great domed hall. The star constellation Orion?
Yes.
To get here, you have to move through a portal. Instead of traveling through space and taking a lot of time to get here, you simply move through a portal. Nick stared at Balthazar, and then frowned.
I wish I could understand what you're talking about.
Let me give you a demonstration. Balthazar looked to one of the men of the White Brotherhood, who looked up at the center of the domed roof. He lifted his hands, palm upwards, and closed his eyes. The ornate ceiling opened as if it were sliding glass. What looked to Nick like a metal plate floated gracefully and slowly downwards in a perfect vertical line. It moved as if it were light as a feather. Did gravity exist here? From the floor, near, to where Nick was standing, the dove rose from its crystal encasement to meet the plate. Nick blinked and looked down at the crystal the dove had been covered in. It was liquid, and moved about throwing off rainbow shafts of light. The dove spread its wings and received the plate on its back. Nick could see now that it was not metal at all. It was something like moving, shimmering silver-colored liquid, and as it began to spin, it shot light beams upwards into the room.
What is that?
Nick asked Balthazar. As Nick's voice sounded across the room, the light immediately formed pictures. It was a picture of Nick looking confused. In his head, lots of different pictures were spinning and bumping into each other. He had a frown on his face. The picture faded in and out, and sometimes formed the snowy interference dots that he saw when his TV wasn't properly tuned into a particular station. As you can see, it's a sound translator. It translates sound into pictures. It is part of us. When we speak, it forms pictures. We only use it for our students because they sometimes find it difficult to understand what we are teaching. They hear words, but not their meaning. You know what I mean. There have been times when you have spoken to people and later found that they did not really understand what you were trying to say, even though you used all the right words. This machine makes sure the true meaning of what we say is clear to the student. Yes, up there I looked exactly the way I feel, completely baffled. But what happens when you all talk at once? Nick asked. We never speak when another is speaking. We only listen with respect. Human beings have yet to learn this lesson. You ask this question because you all are always in competition with each other. No one listens to the next person unless they are saying the same thing that they believe. To listen is to try to understand and respect another person's feelings, even if they think differently to you. Nick laughed to himself. Now that was so right. Everybody always had opinions about things and everyone was always trying to prove that they were right. That's why people talked at the same time. No wonder the world was always at war. Nobody bothered to listen to each other. Let me help you understand how you are here in Orion. Balthazar paused for a moment to allow the pictures above the dove to disappear. Then, he began to talk again and new pictures flashed in the air above them. The planets and stars in the night sky only appear to be far from each other. If you get into a space rocket and use time and distance to get from one planet to another, then you will experience the sensation of time and distance. Pictures of space travel flashed before Nick. Rockets glided through the black void of space as their clocks showed millions of years passing before a planet was reached. Distance and time are not real. They are just part of the life drama. Human beings are playing a game where they are rooted to one place, and all other places are far from them. Time and distance are just part of the game. Nick watched a school nativity play taking place on a stage. It was a primary school. Children were taking roles in the play: Mary, Jesus, the shepherds, Joseph and the three wise men. On another stage, positioned right next to the nativity play, was a different drama going on. This performance was about space aliens and such things. Some kids were dressed up in space suits and some had scary costumes that made them look like space monsters.
A rocket ship took off from its stage and traveled all around the hall where the two plays were taking place. The clock in the rocket showed millions of years passing before the craft landed in the middle of the nativity play. The people in the drama imagine all the stage props are real. They think time and distance are real. What they do not realize is that it is all just a game. On the space stage, a kid in a spacesuit walked to the side of the stage and tore a hole in the scenery. He crawled through the hole and punched another hole in the scenery from the nativity stage. Then he stepped through and stood before Mary, Joseph and the others. The characters in the play looked surprised to see a spaceman as well as the space rocket. So, you see, there are portals like this all over the Earth. Orion is one stage play and Earth is another. You don't need spaceships, only portals if you want to get to different places quickly. Balthazar raised his hands and the images faded. The silver liquid plate ascended beyond the glass ceiling and the dove descended into its liquid crystal home. The room was silent and Balthazar paused in stillness. His brothers stood in a soft cloud of gold light, and waited for the words and pictures to become part of Nick's understanding.
I understand now, Nick said finally.
But, he pondered, what about Heliopolis? It seems we have evidence buried under Cairo. Are the remains of this city?
No, you don't have evidence of this place. You have stories of a city to which many traveled and received great teachings of magic and power.
There is no city of Heliopolis under Cairo. There is only a city through which people could enter the portal that leads to Heliopolis. To do this, they had to have tremendous power. It took many, many years of life to reach this level. So, how did the people who wrote of Heliopolis know about it? They were all students of personal power. They found their way to us through the magic of the mind. The writers that you speak of could never give away our secrets. To do so, would alert the custodians. We could not let them know of our work here. All teachings were, and are, secret. These writers came to Egypt to study in the temples with the great priests. After many years of learning, they found their way to us. To reach the White Brotherhood and attend the school of Heliopolis is the greatest honor. It means you have reached the highest level of power. They could never tell others how they were able to reach a city that did not exist in time. They spoke instead of a golden place where they learned many things. Readers and listeners could only guess where these students had gained their knowledge. They guessed in the same way as historians and archaeologists do. So this is Orion?
Wow!
Nick was still trying to take all this in. But who are the Orions? What have you got to do with us human beings? We are some of the original Earth people. It is a long story that all of you Horus Taskers will understand if you find the keys of Amenti'es for this place. This is a world all human beings dream of, that they deserve if they are prepared to take back their power. You have to be powerful to live in a world like this. But why? Because your thoughts create your world. You will learn this on your journey. If your thoughts are negative, as those of human beings mostly are, then you create a difficult world to live in. Human beings are afraid of being poor, of dying, getting hurt, getting ill, working too hard or working too little, afraid of homework, afraid of everything. When people are afraid, they make everyone else afraid and they don't live happy lives. But then, how did I get here? I'm not a student of power. You are a Horus Tasker. Yes, I learned that fact from Ali Mehmet. Horus Taskers have great knowledge. You are related to us. You have strands of our DNA, which is the memory of your power. You simply have to remember this power. We gave you the sacred white powder because your DNA recognizes it. It does not have the same effect on everyone. The body has to recognize it. Will Noah be able to use the sacred white powder? All Horus Taskers can use it. Other people, ordinary human beings for example, must take it over a longer period of time for it to work. They have to change their diets, their behaviors and the way that they think before it will have the effect that it has on you. The scroll said that the priests of the temples used to give it to their students. They only gave it to those who were of a very high level of personal power. They had to take a journey to reach us, but that journey tested everything they had learned. It tested their power. If they failed, they did not reach us,
What happened to them?
They were taken by the dark gatekeepers to the Ashen Forest. It is a very dark place, full of terrible, unspeakable evil. To get past the dark gatekeepers requires great personal power.
They can escape, but have to look for the power inside themselves before this happens.
Why am I here now?
To remember the prophecy of Osiris.
The prophecy lies within you.
You have already learned a great deal from us, although you do not remember.
Your daughter going missing started the whole search for Osiris, which is a search for personal power.
Lara's kidnap was part of a grand plan to begin the unfolding of the prophecy.
She was kidnapped for sure?
Will she be all right?
I cannot say.
It is up to you and the others.
Success lies in understanding the real story of Osiris.
I know the story of Osiris from the history books, but how is it related to personal power?
The story of Osiris is a riddle.
You will find out the truth as you go.
To know power, you have to find it in yourself.
I cannot tell you to have power.
As you uncover the story of Osiris and what it means, so you realize who and what you are.
It sounds complicated.
Maybe it is.
But you will begin uncovering the truth once the journey begins.
It is important that you do well because you will have to fight dreadful evil using your personal power.
Dreadful evil?
Nick's voice was faint, lost somewhere in the back of his throat.
Yes.
We have to prepare you.
You have a very difficult task ahead.
You are going to need every ounce of power to survive.
You are going to make a journey to the Ashen Forest.
Ali Mamet, Noah and Melissa sat in silence. A figure started forming in the center of the light. It was a woman. As she moved, her body threw out shafts of rainbow light. Sister Abigail.
Ali Mamet gasped and put out his hands to her image.
Greetings, loved ones, Sister Abigail called cheerily.
What's with the gawping faces?
You're not used to magic yet?
Still getting surprises?
In fact, I have another surprise for you. Sister Abigail looked around at the three awestruck faces.
Someone I know needs to speak to you. Sister Abigail's image slowly faded without waiting for any response from the others.
In her place, a scene appeared. There was a green meadow with trees, a small brook, and near the meadow a bridge. It was silver with bright stones of different colors. Someone sat on the bridge, right in the middle. Lara was sitting on a small rock in the meadow, with her eyes closed. Her mouth didn't move, but they could hear her voice.
Noah.
Noah.
I need you to hear me, Noah.
Noah jumped up from the ground where he was sitting.
I hear you, Lara.
I hear you.
Noah was overjoyed to see his sister.
Lara sat still.
She repeated the same phrase.
Noah.
Noah.
I need you to hear me, Noah.
She can't hear me.
Noah turned to his mother.
Sit, Noah.
Sister Abigail's voice cried out of nowhere.
Focus on her.
Focus your energy.
Don't shout to the image that you see.
Speak to her mind.
Focus your message to her mind.
Noah fell to the ground and sat cross-legged as Ali Mamet had done earlier.
He focused the words, I hear you, it is sister.
He formed an image of her face in his mind and imagined himself becoming her body.
Then, he focused the words again, I hear you, Lara.
Ali Mamet and Melissa watched the image of Lara in the crystal light.
She sat still, chanting the same phrase over and over again.
Suddenly, her chanting stopped. Another voice could be heard. It was Noah's.
Melissa looked over at her son, who was focusing his words silently.
She couldn't hear him here, but she heard him in the crystal light.
Lara looked up.
She closed her eyes again and smiled.
She heard him.
Melissa leaned over to Noah and whispered, she hears you, Noah, speak to her now.
Noah spoke.
Lara.
Where are you?
Noah heard the answer in the crystal light.
I'm in a place called Rainbow's End, Noah.
It will be difficult for you to get here.
So how did you get there?
They brought me here, King Tut's men.
They brought me through the Great Pyramid.
But we came through a portal. They used some sort of machine to make the humming sounds. The hum changes the body, Noah.
It's all right, Lara, we know about that, but we don't know how to make the sounds ourselves.
We've got the sacred powder.
That might help,
or we might have to find their machines. We'll get you out.
Noah, I have to get out soon.
The Dark Gatekeepers are coming for me.
I know.
Ali Mehmet told us.
Can't you remember how you got there, Lara, the exact route I mean?
Yes, I remember, but I'm not sure how to get back without a homing machine. I'll try, but if I do get back into the pyramid, what then?
I'll be stuck between dimensions.
Tell me exactly what happened, Lara.
We have to try something.
The three of them listened carefully as Lara described her journey to Rainbow's End. Not only did she tell them about the Lady Madonna and the children, but she also spoke of her conversations with the Lady and her talks with the Masters of Time. They learned more about the Horus Taskers and the awesome challenge that lay ahead.
Noah, I have a message for Mum in all of this.
Melissa sat up. Tell her to have complete trust in herself. She gets very afraid of getting things wrong, and then doesn't do them. If she is to succeed as a Horus Tasker, she must not ask so many questions. She must just follow her heart, even if things don't seem to add up.
Lara gave a smile, and Melissa wiped tears from her eyes.
We will succeed together, if we have faith and trust in ourselves. We have to believe we can do it, otherwise we will definitely fail.
Noah focused carefully now on his sister.
Lara, we have to talk as much as possible. I want you to try to find your way back into the Great Pyramid.
I'll try to find my way to the dimension that they took you to.
After that, I don't know. They're going to close the pyramid, so we'll have to figure something out.
Let's try and meet halfway.
I can't think of any other plan for now.
We have to start somewhere.
Okay, Noah. We have to believe we can do it. We will meet, okay?
No question about it.
No question.
See you soon.
In person.
Melissa, Noah and Ali Mehmet watched as the image of Lara faded.
Melissa felt a stab of panic, and then calmed herself.
Her daughter had spoken.
She, Melissa, would have to have complete trust in herself. All her questions, all her worry, would get her nowhere.
Melissa knew that she still had a lot to learn, but that she didn't have time to sit pondering over these new wonders.
She'd have to do just as Lara said.
She'd have to trust.
Well, she'd simply do her level best.
She looked at the others, who were deep in thought.
We'd better get going, guys. We'll have Abdul Bakr's men on our tails before we know it.
I know I've got places to go.
I won't ask questions, I'll just figure it out as I go.
I'll try to trust the whole process.
Noah, you've got a lot to figure out.
We don't know where Nick is, but I'm going to try not to worry.
As for you, Ali Mehmet, what are you going to do?
Chapter 6 The Lion People of Orion. Melissa stared up at the Sphinx. This huge statue of the lion with the man's face and headdress of an Egyptian pharaoh, rested in the sand, silent and secretive, holding the mysteries of thousands of years of Egyptian life. She stood between the gigantic paws and looked up at its towering body looming up into the early afternoon sky. She felt its force. It was overwhelming, like the task ahead of her. She frowned and bit her lip. How on earth was she to get in here? A lot of strange things had happened lately, but the magic didn't seem to want to happen now.
Ali Mehmet had said she was to come here, but why?
How was she to do whatever it was she had to do? In her search for the right spot to enter the place, if she could enter that was, she'd walked around the great statue twice. Now she was exhausted. The heat of the sun and the length of the journey were too much for her. She sank to the floor and took out her water bottle. It was cooler here. The sun was moving behind the great lion, and its head cast a shadow that Melissa was grateful for. After a long drink, she felt better. She stayed in the shade for a while, lounging into the warm sand and resting her head back against a large granite block covered in ancient Egyptian hieroglyphics. She closed her eyes. It had been a stressful time. She felt sleepy, but no. She mustn't sleep. What about? She dozed and saw the woman in the cream tunic, Melissa.
Come.
Get up and walk.
Melissa blinked and stared at the woman while trying to heave herself up from her spot. She knew she was asleep, yet she was also awake.
She stood to meet the woman whose hair fell to her waist in a straight shiny yellow mane. She was odd-looking. Melissa tried to focus on the strangeness, but then the woman spoke. "I'm Celine." The woman put her hand out and took Melissa's into her own. Her hands, they were soft, and did the back of them have a fine golden coat of hair? "Come. Stand over here." Melissa looked into the bizarre, almost too bright green eyes and nodded. That was it. Celine looked like a cat. Her skin was silky and smooth. She had a creamy complexion on a small oval face. Her tiny mouth was upturned and heart-shaped, and her nose small and petite. Her almond-shaped eyes turned up slightly at the corners. She definitely looked like a cat. "Where are we going?" Melissa asked, as the woman stepped along the small opening between the paws of the Sphinx. Celine stopped and put her hands on Melissa's shoulders, turning her to face the body of the lion. Melissa saw that the granite block had gone. Just the lower breast of the lion stood bare and smooth, almost brand new looking. Melissa turned back to Celine. "Do you know where the opening is? Are you here to help me? Who are you exactly?"
"I don't even know you. Why do I need to follow you?"
"SSHH. So many questions." The woman grabbed Melissa's hands again and looked into her eyes. "Your journey for personal power begins here. Do you know what it is you are searching for?"
"Why, yes, of course.
My daughter, Lara, she's gone missing, and I know about Lara. But what is it you are looking for?"
"Well, if you know about Lara, then you know. What is it that you are looking for, Melissa?
If you cannot answer the question, you cannot pass through the portal."
"The portal?" But where? Melissa swung her head in every direction, looking for a cave, a tunnel, or something to indicate there was a way into this place.
"Where is it?"
Celine stood watching Melissa's eyes, moving from here to there, searching. She watched as Lara's mother began walking from the paws along to the breast of the lion, running her hands along the rock surface, searching for an opening while at the same time marveling at its smoothness. In her waking world, the lion was as old as time, and it looked it.
"Melissa!" The woman called sharply. Melissa turned her head, startled at Celine's tone.
"You are not ready to go through this portal. You will have to take the route of the dead. On this road, you will find your answer to my question. Until you know this answer, I cannot allow you through. Take the journey of the Duat."
"But, you can't." Melissa's voice trailed off as Celine simply vanished into thin air. She ran to the spot where the woman had stood and let out a frustrated breath.
"What now?"
Melissa sat down in the same spot as before, only this time she leaned against the breast of the lion. She was sleepy again and dozed. Melissa awoke as dusk was settling in. The sun was sinking further down into the depths of the horizon. She leapt up and dusted herself down. Why had she slept when there was work to be done?
Why?
She stamped her foot as tears of fury stung her eyes. What was the matter with her? Where was Celine? Was Celine just part of a dream? Why couldn't she find her daughter? Melissa looked up into the darkening sky and let out a loud yell, "Help me!" Abdul Baker was terrified. How on earth was he going to break this to the boss? He'd be thrown to the dark gatekeepers. Those ugly, menacing creatures liked a treat of green slime for dessert. It was a horrible fate. Those who were fed to them had failed in their duties in one way or another. They ended up being part of the bodies of the dark gatekeepers, never escaping until the revolting creatures died. Only then could they return to their own dimension. When the dead dark gatekeeper's body had rotted, Abdul Baker shivered at the thought. What was he to do? If he did tell the others, he was finished. He was lucky to get out of the chamber in one piece. That dastardly boy had known about the tonic. He seemed to know as much as his sister. And what was that old fool Ali Mehmet doing traveling? How did they all know about stuff like that? This whole thing was now pretty much out of control, and guess who was going to get the blame? Every one of those Rainfords was a danger to the world order. They just seemed to know things. How they knew was anybody's guess. Abdul Baker was at a loss. What were his choices? Not telling put the whole world system of slavery in danger. If this got out to the press, and that Rainford fellow liked to talk to the newspapers, the human race would realize what was going on and things would start to change. Yet if he did let the others know what was happening, he'd be finished off. Why should he be noble? If his boss, Seth, weren't such a drama queen, if he were more reasonable, he'd tell the truth about the big mess-up. If he couldn't be part of things because the boss couldn't keep his temper, why should he save their world? The other two aides had met their fate down in the subterranean chamber and were gone. Finished. Dead. They'd probably gone to the great graveyard in the galaxy. They had been important members of Seth's circle of custodians. How he was going to explain their disappearance was another huge problem. To be here in this world was a privilege. Only a few were selected to be part of the leading circle. They'd been together since the whole takeover had started. All of them were trusted members of Seth's team. Well, he'd just have to think of something. Being here in this world meant nobody really had to die. Not unless you were stupid enough to have a car accident, get a fatal disease or get in the way of a mad gunman's bullet or something. When the body got old, and the human body got old quickly, they simply took a kid or two from Rainbow's End and absorbed them into the DNA. Their lives were prolonged. Some of them, especially those in prominent positions, presidents or other leading figures in the world, pretended to die when they got old. The authorities put dead human bodies that they took from hospital morgues into the coffins so that people would think them dead. They had state funerals where anybody important attended and made fancy speeches. Then, the real person, still alive, was whipped off to a special clinic and their DNA was given a dose of human child energy. They soon revived, took on some of the characteristics of the human child, were much younger looking and were placed back into society before taking on important positions again. Only a certain number of Abdul Bakr's people could come here from other planets. There was a very strict rule regarding migration his people fought to get here. This was a place of willing slaves. You didn't get a situation as good anywhere else in the universe. His planet was dead after the place had finally blown up during the Fourth War with a neighboring planet. Most of his people had migrated to different worlds, being taken in by kindly nations. They had to look after themselves though, changing their DNA so they would look like the people of their new home planet. This green slime thing was a characteristic of DNA swapping. Mixed DNA was a difficult thing, because unless you were born from the planet itself, you lived with the danger of switching. His own people, living amongst people of other worlds, all wanted to come to Earth. They jostled for a place in the line to get here. But Abdul Bakr and the 11 other aides ensured only a certain number got through at a time. Overpopulation meant that there was more to share, and Abdul Bakr's ruling group did not like to share. So? He had no choice. He would just have to tell his boss and the aides some story to keep them happy. He'd have to take charge of the whole thing himself. Abdul Bakr would have to get help though. He couldn't chase those Rainfords through the dimensions all by himself. He thought for a moment. Who would be the right people for the job? After racking his brains for a while, an idea suddenly dropped into his skull like a rock from the sky. His eyes popped out of their sockets and sat on the edge of his eyelids before springing back into place. He grinned to himself. That was it. With their help, he couldn't fail. The trouble was, nobody could know what he was doing. In fact, if everything went according to plan, who knew what else could happen? Abdul Bakr stood up straight and puffed out his chest. Yes. He quite fancied himself as the next boss. Noah swallowed some of the sacred white powder mixed with water, and waited. Mum had gone off in search of this lion thing that Ali Mehmet had told her about, and Ali Mehmet, well, he hadn't actually said where he was going. He'd just mumbled something about Sister Abigail and had crawled after Noah's mother in the tunnel. Noah focused on Lara. He thought that if he kept her face in his mind, somehow the powder might take him to her. He didn't know this for sure, but there was no rule book for this sort of thing. Nothing was happening just yet, but then Dad had taken a while before he vanished. He'd just have to wait, and hope that Abdul Bakr and his cronies didn't show up soon. After a while, Noah got tired of focusing on Lara. He felt like his whole body had pins and needles. Hey, was this it? Was he changing? Noah looked around. Everything was still the same. The pins and needles continued. He was feeling itchy as well, but he didn't quite know where to scratch it himself. He looked up suddenly to a sound. It was a shuffling noise out of nowhere. Someone appeared a few feet away from him. It was a man, a very tall man. His head almost touched the rock ceiling of the chamber. He wore a black cape and black boots. His hair was golden and fell to his shoulders. "Hello, Noah," the man boomed. His voice was deep and loud. Noah peered at him through the gloom of the darkened chamber. His face looked odd. It was heavy and furry. Was this man, was he half lion? "Hello," Noah said warily. "Don't fear me, Noah," the man said. "Why do you look like a lion?" Noah needed to make sense of the man's appearance. "I am from Orion. We are the cat people. The lions on your planet are our relatives. They are here for a reason you will not understand now." "Oh." Noah took a deep breath. "Did I switch dimensions?" "Yes, but you'll return in a moment. You are not ready for your journey just yet. I am here to offer you some advice. You have to follow the path of the Duat if you are to find your sister." "The path of the what?" "But I said I'd meet her in a different dimension." "Here maybe. And you will do so, but not yet. This portal is blocked off to you by the dark gatekeepers. To get past them, you need special skills and you do not possess them. If I let you pass through, you will be carried off by them for sure." "Phew." Noah thought the whole thing sounded awesome. "Like the movies. What skills are you talking about?" "Focus. Confidence. The ability to see your own vision rather than the one they will give you. You must believe in your own way of doing things and not follow the way of others because their ideas seem better than yours." "But that's easy. I am already focused and confident. I always do my own thing." Noah was up for a battle against the dark gatekeepers. "Focus. Confidence. This is Noah you're talking about. No. You must take the journey of the dead. On this road, you will develop the skills to fight the influence of the dark gatekeepers."
"Journey of the dead?
Listen, I don't have time for this riddle thing. Until you learn of the Duat and take the journey, I shall not point out the way. Remember these words as you try to make sense of everything. As above, so below. As above, so hold on a minute. So you can actually get me there? Hey now, please, you don't know me. I'm really Noah." Stopped mid-sentence as the man disappeared. He was gone. What a nerve. Noah was annoyed that anyone would not think him focused or confident. Geez. What now? Fat lot of good that powder stuff was, if all it got him was a good-for-nothing lion man in a cape who didn't let him pass the first gate. Noah kicked the rubble in a fit of temper. He looked around and down at the tunnel entrance. He'd have to go back to the hotel and find out what this Duat thing was. Ali Mehmet sat in his room and stared at his tiny glass of tea. He'd put so much sugar in it that some of the crystals hadn't been able to dissolve in the warm brown liquid. He'd come to his little hideaway home in the guard barracks after Melissa and he had left the Great Pyramid. Now, he was deep in thought. What next? Where was everyone? Where was Lara? What was he to do now? Ali Mehmet was afraid. He knew he had to help Lara, but he only had to think about the dark gatekeepers and his legs turned to jelly. To actually go find them and deliberately get into a fight with the horrible creatures was feeling right now like a fate worse than death. His ears started ringing. Oh, oh. He knew what that meant. Sister Abigail was on the warpath. He'd felt blessed all his life to have friends like her, yet in these difficult times, he dreaded her presence. He didn't see her as any help, rather as a thorn in his side. She kept reminding him to use his power. Oh heck, that. Ali Mehmet liked all the ideas she taught him, but now he didn't want to face his fears because that meant facing those dark gatekeepers. Using his power was better talked about than done. The ringing continued and gradually got louder. He fought the sound. He made himself think of something else. He sat forward on his wicker chair and sipped at his tea. He brought his mind to the thought of his nephew, Hassan, and all the archaeological trips he had been on with Hassan's family. They'd traveled a lot, what good times. He loved Hassan's family. They'd all done so much together. Ali Mehmet had never married. He'd loved a woman once, he still loved her a long time ago when he was a young man. But she'd only been a visitor to Egypt. They'd had a wonderful romance and then she left with her parents, that was 40 years ago, and he'd never given his heart to another. He thought of her now, she'd been a vision of beauty with a mane of flaming red hair and the deepest sea-green eyes. He'd loved her from the moment he set eyes on her. They'd run through Giza, seen all the monuments, sipped tea together in the local tea houses. They'd kissed in the moonlight. By the time the weeping Ali Mehmet had reached down to his large box of men's tissues on the floor beside his bed, he realized the ringing was gone. Wow. This was a first. He had never done that before. He had the power to chase off Sister Abigail if he wanted. Ali Mehmet jumped off his chair with the ease of a teenager. He laughed. He loved Sister Abigail, but right now she was scary. She expected things of him. He needed to rest. So, much stuff had been happening, and he was weary of it all. He needed to sleep. Ali Mehmet peered out of the window of his small room. The sun was still high and it was extremely hot. He looked at the inviting bed and threw himself down on it. Sleep. Yes, that's what he'd do. Nick was on the steps of the underground labyrinth, a maze of tunnels that lay under the Temple of Orion. Balthazar had led him from the great domed hall into what looked like the dungeons of hell. Nick could not believe that such a place existed in so beautiful a city as Heliopolis. He said this to Balthazar, who stood behind him on the steps leading down from the floor of the great building. They'd traveled downwards a long way and now they'd stopped because Nick needed to take a few breaths before going any further. Ah! Balthazar smiled. For human beings, such beauty and wisdom as you find in Heliopolis is lost, forgotten. Heliopolis is only a dream to humanity. This is their idea of heaven. To create a place like this, people have to remember their power. So what is this place, Balthazar? Asked Nick. These tunnels all lead somewhere, and they come from somewhere. For people like you who have to find something important, you have to travel these tunnels. There isn't another way for you to go. Some of the tunnels come from lower dimensions like the Earth. People who seek their power, and use it, find their way through the maze of corridors and end up here. Those who don't make it, end up in frightful places. I don't really understand, Nick said. He stayed on the higher levels of the steps, afraid to go down any further. As the steps descended, the light was fading and Nick was barely able to see his feet. The smell was a mixture of damp earth and moldy brickwork, with a hint of rotting vegetables. Why do people have to take this route? Can't they cut through a portal, or something? The tunnels test you. They show you things that make you realize your power. You could use a portal, but when you got to where you were going, you would not have the power you needed to take what you wanted. Why is the place so eerie? It is this way because it is haunted by the thoughts of those who are lost here. It is the creation of human beings who cannot let go of their fear. To enter this place is to enter within the self. So how do I get to the Ashen Forest? There are many routes, many choices of tunnel. Only one route will lead there. But how big is this maze? How can I find a route without a map? The place is endless. Many people started out in Earth time many thousands of years ago and still wander the maze looking for direction. Some reach us, and some get caught and captured by the demons that lurk in certain tunnels. The route is inside of you. Everybody has a dream for their lives. The route to that dream lies within them. Within us all is the true map, the route to our own happiness. Your happiness lies in the accomplishment of your task in the Ashen Forest. The route to the Ashen Forest is inside of you. It sounds too far-fetched. If what you're saying is true, wouldn't everybody reach their dreams? Balthazar looked at Nick long and hard. Come with me. He took Nick's arm and led him further and further down the steps until they came into blackness. As they reached flat ground, Nick could feel the hardened soil beneath his shoes. He was blind and felt panic rising in his body. His eyes moved around frantically in their sockets as they searched for some light to guide them. He reached out his arms, seeking Balthazar, and felt the comfort of his companion's shoulder.
"This is the void, Nick, the eternal blackness. Everything that you want is created in the void. But you told me this is the labyrinth.
I can't see a thing.
Don't you leave me here.
This is the labyrinth.
This is the maze of your mind.
But you said that other people have been wandering here for thousands of years.
Yes.
But everyone in our lives is a mirror image of our thoughts. So if you see people, you see yourself. What and whom you see here are the thoughts that are in the deep places of your mind. The labyrinth is like your dreams. All your thoughts show up in the form of people and things and situations.
I can't see a thing that you want to show me.
Stop trying to use your physical eyes, Nick. See with the body.
But I don't understand. How do I see with the body?
As a child, didn't you ever wake up at night looking at your room, only to realize that you had the blankets over your face?
Yes.
I do remember that.
So just see like that now.
See with your mind.
Don't try to see, just see.
Nick relaxed. He stopped focusing on what his mind could not see. He remembered what Ali Mehmet had said. The third eye, he should use the real eye, the imagination. He made a decision to just see. All of a sudden, the place where they were standing came into full view. It was as if someone had switched on a light. Nick could see the grimy bricked walls and the damp moldy ceilings above him. They stood in a corridor, along which many tunnels went off in different directions.
Do you understand now?
Balthazar asked, looking at Nick.
Human beings can see all things if they want to. They are so used to using their physical eyes that they have forgotten that they have sight even without them.
Balthazar ushered Nick down the corridor and into a closed space. It was a sort of large, bricked room with an open entrance. In the corner, a man with filthy long straggling hair sat crouching and scared as they looked at him. His face was smeared with dirt and his robes were blackened, torn and ragged. As he whimpered helplessly, Nick saw his teeth, both yellowed and rotten, hanging from diseased gums. He was young looking.
"This is Tom,"
Balthazar said, looking at the man sadly. "He's been wandering the labyrinth these last 300 years. Down here, time does not exist, but I gave you time frames so you can understand how long human beings can take to learn to find their power."
"Can't we help him?"
Nick asked, looking at Tom's cowering body. He was so afraid.
"We cannot," Balthazar replied, looking at Nick.
He chose the path of power by entering the labyrinth. In his earthly life, he was very unhappy. He was afraid of many things. He decided to study the way to power, which means he had to learn how to give up his fears. Eventually, he found his way to the labyrinth. The time came for him to enter this place to face his fears. Facing our fears is the only way we can know that they are there and the only way that we can let them go. That is what he is doing. It is a rule that all those who enter must find us, no matter how long it takes. It is a rule he understands. But he's afraid.
Of course he is.
He has been in this room for months. He is terrified to leave it because he has encountered many demons that he has created through his fear.
Why are you showing me this man?
Tom is lost. At this moment, his fear is stronger than his vision of finding Heliopolis. He was trying to find his way to us, but then he started getting ideas of failing in his mind. The idea of failure creates a demonic picture. Now, all he sees are demons. When he starts focusing on finding us again, he'll find his way to us. That is how creation works. You hold an idea in your head and then eventually it shows up in your life. Nick peered into the room and shivered. He didn't want to end up like Tom.
I'm afraid.
Of course you are.
Remember, nothing happens by chance.
You create everything in your life. You are tasked with finding the Ashen Forest and doing what we have prepared you for. And once this is done, as a Horus Tasker, you will share this experience with others. It is your task as an Egyptologist to share the legacy of power with others.
Nick took a deep breath.
He carefully put one foot forward. He looked up into Balthazar's caring eyes and said softly, "Somebody once said that the journey of 1,000 miles begins with the first step." Lara was pleased. She made contact with Noah and she was now trying to hatch a plan to get back to the pyramid. She'd return to the bridge in case Noah wanted to get in touch. She'd spoken to him here, so she saw it as a good luck token. Maybe it would give her more luck in thinking up ways to get home. Lara was also happy because she'd noticed that her parents' child selves had faded quite a lot. Noah was just a wisp of energy, though from time to time all of them returned to normal. The lady had told her it was a good sign because the adults were obviously trying to trust themselves more and were making efforts to release their fears. Lara sat in the evening sun, waiting for an idea to form in her head. The sun was moving down closer to the horizon. It wouldn't be long before it was dark. She rubbed her hand on the cobblestones beneath her. "Come on. Give me your energy. Give me your knowledge. Help me like you did Noah." She sat still and nothing came. "Transport me back to the pyramid." Lara tried to stay fixed to the spot but couldn't help wriggling around. Her bottom was getting cramped. She focused on the birdsong and the soft whisper of the breeze in her ear. This was good. There was a rustling sound. Lara's ears picked up on the faint noise. The birds continued their chatter and the rustle remained. She looked around. Nothing moved except the tree branches. They waved and did they rustle? The noise was different to the rustle of leaves. Her eyes fixed on the end of the bridge towards the closed portal. No, it wasn't a rustle, it was more of a march. Was it a march of feet through long grass? Someone was behind her on the grass verge. It was the lady. She looked panicked. "Lara," she said, walking closer to the bridge, "they're coming." Lara looked at her. "Who?" She stopped and glanced back at the closed portal. "Oh." She jumped up and ran to the lady. "I was trying to get out, Lady Madonna. The bridge brought me luck with Noah, but this afternoon it didn't help me." "The bridge? What are you talking about, Lara? The bridge didn't help you with Noah. You helped you. Here is your first lesson to command power. You have to own it." "Own it? You create your experience, Lara. The lucky charms don't create it. You have given your power to the bridge and now the dark gatekeepers are approaching." The two of them looked over at the portal. It was definitely a marching of feet. "How far away are they, Lady Madonna?"
"Not far at all. They'll be here by morning. You've got to work through the night, it's the way things always were."
Lara looked at the lady and then put her hands to her head. She'd already wasted time looking for help outside of herself. She looked over at the portal again and swallowed hard. The dark gatekeepers were coming, and she was terribly afraid. Chapter 7 The Journey of the Dead. Seth was disturbed. He sat on his elaborately decorated chair and looked at the circle of empty seats. His eyes moved warily to the place where Abdul Baki usually sat. Something wasn't right with that man. He was keeping something from Seth and the aides. Abdul Baki had been on his team since the very beginning, when they'd first hijacked the Earth. The man was good at his job. He snooped around and poked his nose into everyone's business. Abdul Baki was the person who was the true head of all the secret government agencies around the world. These secret groups kept an eye on people to make sure that nobody would change the way Seth had organized the world. If someone did try to change things, the aides would make sure that the person got killed or was removed from their jobs. Of course, everybody who worked as spies in these agencies thought that they were controlled by people of their own country, but those in the top jobs knew who the real bosses were. The custodians were known as the invisible ones to the highest government people around the world. They never attended any gatherings or conferences. They just ran the whole world from this hall in Egypt. Seth and his aides had sat together in the beginning and invented slavery. The ideas they came up with were wonderful. One of the aides was responsible for inventing money and banks. Another invented the idea of jobs. Human beings could work lots of hours in a day for very little money. Then the money they earned had to be put into a bank, which charged them for putting it there. Human beings never argued about these things because another of his aides came up with the idea that if the human people were made to hate each other, they would concentrate on fighting together rather than on the slavery. So sometimes the aide would tell governments to create reasons to have wars with other countries. Or the wars could be in their countries between people of different religions or different colors. It was easy to come up with reasons to make people hate each other. Humans believed anything they were told. Seth had never met any race like this one in all the planets he had visited. When there wasn't a war, one of the aides on Seth's team always made sure that humans had things to take their minds off their problems. Such things were new fashionable toys, clothes, electronics and movies. While humans kept their minds on getting bigger and better things, they didn't question why they were treated like slaves. Now, though, things were not good. Seth could feel it under his skin. And Abdul Bakr was up to something. His eyes had bulged in a funny way when he'd told his story, and Seth had not believed him. He had come running in from the pyramid and warned them all to close the place down. Apparently, the Rainford family kept going there to nose around and look for clues about their missing daughter, and Abdul Bakr was worried that Ali Mehmet, one of the older security guards, might help them find something. Abdul Bakr believed that Rainford had given Ali Mehmet the sacred white powder for safekeeping and the old man had swallowed some of it. He had found the old man on his own in the pyramid trying to travel. Abdul Bakr said that the powder had had no effect on Ali Mehmet, but that he was planning to make sure the man met with some kind of a fatal accident. He had also said that the two aides who had gone to investigate with him were trailing the family. Funny that. Seth knew Abdul Bakr had his own team of spies to do his dirty work. Why would important people like aides be asked to follow anyone around? They would refuse to do it for a start. Seth felt a cold shiver move up his spine. So where were they then? Where were his two aides? Seth breathed deeply. He always followed his hunches about things and they proved right. He reached down to a small table beside his chair and pressed the buzzer on the intercom phone. A voice answered. Get in here now, he commanded his chief aide, something's gone badly wrong. Melissa and Noah crouched over the pile of books on the cool polished floor of Hassan's home. Warm air wafted in from open French windows and the early night sky showed off its sparkling treasure to anyone who cared to look. Ali Mehmet's nephew was pointing out some diagrams and explaining their meaning. Hassan's English friends had practically barged into his home earlier on this evening and asked for books on information about the Duat. The Duat? Hassan had questioned them with knotted eyebrows. The Duat? Where's Nick? He knows about stuff like this. Nick's out with the police somewhere, Melissa had said quickly. We need the information urgently. But why? What's going on? Hassan, Melissa said carefully, it's about us finding Lara. I can't go into the whole story, you'd never believe it for a start, but if you can just give us some information, we'd be grateful. Ali Mehmet will probably explain it better, Noah piped up. Ahh. Uncle Ali. Now that figures. Hassan had stared at the pair of them. They looked disheveled, like a couple of tramps. They were dusty and tired looking. His heart went out to them. It must be terrible to lose your family member. Whatever they wanted, he'd give them. Uncle Ali was probably spinning them one of his famous stories of adventures through pyramids with wild Aborigine women. He'd heard them all as he was growing up. Trouble was, Uncle had now gone too far with his tales. These people were mad with grief. They would believe anything if they thought they might get their child back. Perhaps they thought that by following the path of the dead. Okay, Hassan said. I'll get the books so we can look at the pictures. I'll explain the rest. The Duat, Hassan explained, was believed by the ancient Egyptians to be the kingdom of the dead, a place ruled by Osiris. Do you know who Osiris was, Noah? Sort of. Dad told us the stories of the gods, but I can't remember much now. He was one of the children of the earth god, Jeb, and the sky goddess Nut, wasn't he? That's right. There were four children, Osiris, Seth, Nephthys and Isis. Osiris married Isis and they ruled over Egypt together. Osiris was the very first pharaoh, and Seth became jealous of his power. Eventually, Seth killed his brother Osiris and cut up his body into 14 parts. He then spread the bits and pieces all around Egypt, hoping they wouldn't be found. But Isis, being a very determined woman, found all the parts except one, and put her husband back together. She used her special powers to breathe life back into her husband. The one part of him that was missing was his phallus. His phallus? No one inquired. His penis, Melissa raised her eyes as she said the word. Because it was missing, Hassan continued, she couldn't make a baby, so she made an artificial penis and placed it on Osiris' body where the old one should have been. Then, she became pregnant and gave birth to Horus. How did she manage that? Noah asked doubtfully. I think, Melissa said pondering the question, that in the light of all this information we've heard in the last 24 hours, it means that she used special DNA methods to make that child. You know, like those sky people did when they first got here. What? Hassan asked in astonishment. What are you talking about? Melissa suddenly realized what she'd said. Oh, nothing. It was just a thought. Carry on, Hassan. Hassan looked down at his books with a worried frown. Melissa wasn't well. Someone should give her some pills or something. At least until they find Lara, if they ever find the poor girl. He went on. Osiris left for the skies and created a kingdom there. His son Horus grew up and went on to challenge his uncle Seth. He beat Seth and took over the throne of Egypt. When Horus died, he followed a special path that eventually rejoined him with his father Osiris. All the pharaohs that followed were supposed to be Horus reincarnated. He was reborn into the bodies of the reigning kings, in other words. So he went up to the skies to join his father, and then returned again to rule in another person's body? Noah inquired. Yes and no, if you look up there now, come, I'll show you. Hassan got up and walked through the French windows onto a tiled terrace. The others followed. Look up there. He pointed to the Orion constellation. Noah could make out the form of the Great Hunter. Finding the three stars of Orion's belt was the easiest way to begin tracing out the figure. That area and beyond is the new kingdom that Osiris created. That area is the Duat. Noah studied the dark glittering sky with interest. So what exactly is the journey of the dead? The ancient Egyptian pharaohs believed in reincarnation, that human beings were born again into new bodies when they died in the old one. They were reborn, that is, if they didn't pass the tests in the astral plane. The astral is the place that the human soul goes to after death. These pharaohs called themselves the sons of Horus and, when they died, they believed that if their souls were pure, they would return to the body of Osiris after they were dead. To get to Osiris was a difficult thing, though, because they had to face all sorts of horrible things to test how pure they were. They would spend 70 days doing the journey and if they passed, reunited with their father. The sons of Horus, or pharaohs, learned many things about the astral plane before they died. They learned how to get past all evil situations they encountered. If they forgot their knowledge, they were either hauled off by demons and things or were simply reborn into human bodies. Tell me more about this astral plane. Noah hadn't heard about this place. He bent his neck forward onto his chest. It was getting a bit stiff from looking upwards. It's supposed to be the place we go when we die. In that place, we apparently meet all our demons that we create with our thoughts. All the horrible things we did to, or thought about other people while we were alive, come back to haunt us on the astral level. It sounds horrible. Do you believe that, Hassan? Noah's eyes were wide and questioning. After all the mean things he'd done to Lara, all the pranks, all the cursing, he shuddered at the thought. Who knows? Hassan shrugged. The ancient Egyptians certainly believed it all. They wrote enough about it, after all. So what is the meaning of as above so below? The ancient Egyptians believed that the sky and the ground were the same thing. In other words, the places in the sky can be found on the ground. Is that true? Well, some Egyptologists have found that to be the case. Two very interesting Egyptologists discovered that the three stars of Orion's belt were lined up in exactly the same way as the three pyramids of Giza.
Oh yeah.
Noah exclaimed, suddenly remembering Dad talking about it. There were programs on TV about that.
Yes, and since then, they and others have found that the pyramids of the whole Memphis area are all positioned in the same way as the stars in the sky.
Noah went quiet for a moment.
What did all this mean? What was the man in the pyramid, Orion, trying to say?
He'd said something about following the path of the dead, but the dead went on a journey to the stars as above so below.
Hussein, can I see the picture again?
They examined the picture that showed the Duat journey.
It was complicated.
Noah didn't know what it meant.
Melissa looked over at Noah. She was quite lost and hadn't said very much at all.
Hussein, Noah said. Let's say it really is true that what is in the sky is mirrored on the ground. If I were to take a journey to Orion on land, how would I get there?
Good question, Noah.
It is one that has been studied by Egyptologists for a long time. The same two authors we talked about also did some interesting work on the subject. They believe that the journey began on the east bank of the River Nile. Whoever took the journey had to cross the Nile by boat and make their way to the paws of the Sphinx. Once there, the pharaoh, or whoever, had to go through a doorway of some sort. It was supposed to be invisible, a portal to another dimension.
Noah interrupted.
Yes, I suppose so. At this portal, there were two routes to choose from, one by land and one by sea. Both led to the same place, the fifth division of the Duat, or Orion, the three pyramids. In other words, Noah finished.
Hussein stared at his two friends, who were quiet for a moment.
Noah looked over at Melissa thoughtfully, then, still keeping his eyes on his mother, put a question to Hussein.
Hussein, do you believe the stories about the sacred white powder? Do you believe that they have magical powers as the scroll said they did?
By now, Noah was looking at the man whom he knew was quite confused by all these questions put to him at this rather strange hour.
Well, I never really thought, neither did I, Melissa piped up all of a sudden.
She looked at Noah, then squarely at Hussein. I thought it was all hocus pocus.
The lot of it.
Now, though, I know the stuff is everything the scroll said it was.
Hussein scratched his head and frowned.
He didn't know what to say.
In fact, he didn't know what these two were getting at.
Hussein, Noah said slowly, you know the journey of the Duat, right?
Well, I've studied.
Yes, you have.
That's the point.
If we all took the journey together, you know what to expect, where to go.
Yes.
Melissa shouted.
Exactly.
Hussein, you can guide us.
Noah, that's a great idea.
Now Hussein was completely mystified.
What are you talking about?
I don't mean to be rude, Melissa, but have you gone mad?
I know how all this looks, Hussein, believe me, but if you want to help us find Lara, you're going to have to listen very carefully to our story, to the reason why we've been asking these questions.
We need you as our guide.
Hussein didn't speak.
Slowly, the other two began their story.
Abdul Baker shuddered as he spoke.
The dark gatekeeper stood before him, dense black shadows in the gloom of the lower regions of the Great Pyramid. They couldn't keep still. Light from the stars spilled from the upper walls, and they warily watched the rays as they formed the geometric shape at the center of the pyramid. The darkness was their home. Light meant death to them. The energy that came off these creatures was worse than the foulest smell possible. It was energy that made the skin crawl with revulsion. It made Abdul Baker think of every nightmare he had ever had, every horrible story he'd heard, and every terrible picture he had ever seen.
These things made it so a person couldn't concentrate on what he was saying.
Abdul Baker kept stopping and starting the speech he had prepared. He had to focus his mind not to think of all the wickedly bad pictures that kept entering his mind. He tried telling himself that he was in charge these days. Why, if Seth could talk to this lot as if they were his best buddies, well, so could he. Abdul Baker felt a bit more powerful now, but he had to fight to keep his mind clear. The dark gatekeepers listened to the noise that came from the mutant man before them. The noise told them they were going to be busy all night. more humans coming through, more humans to feed on. Excitement went through the crowd. Dark eyes glittered with glee. They liked humans. Humans made good food because they were so afraid of everything. It was easy to scare them. Some of them beat the dark gatekeepers, but not too many of those who were stupid enough to come this way were successful. Some got through the doorways, but often didn't get far. Most of them hid in the dark tunnels, shivering and jellified by terror for all eternity. The mutant man was telling the dark gatekeepers to come out of the doorways. Some still had to guard them, but the rest were to roam in the astral corridors. They weren't normally allowed to do this. Roaming was against the rules in case they were discovered by travelers, those people who could visit the astral world with their minds. Humans were not allowed to know that they were trapped here. They were not to find out that they could never leave the prison and go to the place they called heaven. To get there when they died, they would have to go through the doorways, but the dark gatekeepers put a stop to that. Instead, the useless humans hung around the astral, scared to death by their thoughts and bad deeds, until they were born again into another human body to be used as an energy slave. Ali Mehmet thrashed about in his bed, unable to wake up. His forehead was wet and his pillow drenched, but try as he might, he could not escape from the astral corridors of his traveling mind. Ali Mehmet had tried to run away from the unpleasant situation through sleep, yet now he found himself in a very unsettling place. As he had drifted off on his cool pillow, hoping for the peace of deep slumber, he found himself hurtling towards a huge black spinning hole that looked like it had an eye at its very distant center. He had shrieked as he realized what was happening and had tried to wake himself up by jerking his body violently, but he had just continued spinning out of control until he'd reached the hole. Once he entered the swirling blackness, he seemed to lose sense of himself. He didn't know what had happened to his body. He certainly couldn't feel it. He was just his mind. It felt strange, like he had to work hard to keep himself in one piece. His thoughts wanted to separate from each other and run off in different directions. This was what it felt like to lose your mind, Ali Mehmet thought. This is what mad people did. They lost control of their thoughts. He managed, though, to keep them together just about. He kept plunging through the blackness at such a speed, he felt a sickness in the pit of his stomach, so he still had a body. Ali Mehmet just didn't know where it was. He was obviously still connected to it. He suddenly became aware of the eye. It blinked as he approached it at alarming speed. It looked this way and that, and then suddenly it stared straight at him. Before Ali Mehmet had time even for a frightened whimper, he had spun right through the center of the eye and found himself quite still in a dark, black space. It was silent, and Ali Mehmet felt his thoughts start to spread out again, like treacle escaping from a broken jar. He pulled them back once more. Where was his body? He hadn't realized before how the body kept all the thoughts glued together in one place. This was tough work, trying to keep the mind from running away. He was getting a headache, even though he didn't have a head. Well, not here, anyway. Suddenly there was a sound, a hiss. Someone, something was SSHHing, SSHH, 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 SSHH. Ali Mehmet let go. At once, his thoughts spun from their center and separated into many groups of ideas. Somehow though, as if from some distance, Ali Mehmet looked on, watching the scene as his thoughts took the form of people and things. Ali Mehmet was in the scene now. He was in his own thoughts. In this strange drama he was himself and he was everything else. He was all the actors and all the stage props at the same time. He was in a dark corridor with a low sloping ceiling. There were doorways leading off the corridor and the walls were worn, dirty and damp. Rivulets of water ran down the sides and green moss clung to the surface as dark slime oozed out of cracks in the rock. He heard a cackle of laughter coming from one of the rooms off the corridor. His heart froze in his chest. He didn't like the sound of that voice. It was a familiar one, but he couldn't place it. The cackle sounded again and Ali Mehmet felt as if he was suffocating. He blinked and a dark figure stood before him. It was a man in a black cloak and boots. The cackling sound still carried from the room as the man pointed at Ali Mehmet and with a beckoning finger, ordered the old man to follow him. Unable to do anything else, Ali Mehmet moved behind the man as though magnetized. They moved towards the sound of the strangled laughter, and Ali Mehmet made funny sounds from his throat as he tried to moan. He was too terrified even to get a word out, yet he had no choice but to follow. They stopped outside the entrance to a cave-like area, and the man entered, with Ali Mehmet behind. The smell was almost unbearable, but Ali Mehmet didn't seem to have the ability to lift his hand to his nose to squeeze it shut. He had to experience the stench of rotting flesh. A young woman lay half propped up against the wall. She laughed wildly when she saw them and then suddenly covered her filthy broken-toothed mouth as her eyes widened in terror. She tried to stand as she looked frenziedly at Ali Mehmet. She turned to her side and clawed at the walls, trying to escape their presence. Ali Mehmet knew her. He didn't understand who was she, this young woman. He was frightened and confused. The dark man turned to look at him. His eyes were saying something, then his voice, in perfect Arabic, said, "Look at yourself, look at what you've done." Ali Mehmet looked from the man to the terrible scene as the woman scratched at the walls, her fingers bleeding from rotting nails. She stopped clawing and looked at Ali Mehmet again. He gaped in horror as he realized who she was. Helen. It was Helen. The girl he fell in love with in Cairo all those years ago. He ran to her and tried to take her stinking body into his arms. Her foul breath made him draw back in horror as she opened her mouth to scream. He didn't understand what was Helen doing here. Hadn't she returned to Europe with her family? She was still the same age, yet he had met her 40 years ago. "The mind knows not time, only the body experiences it," came the man's voice. "You gave her up to the caves of the astral. You sent her here." Ali Mehmet looked at the man. "But Helen went back to England. In your mind, you gave her up. You were both in love and you gave each other up. You were scared of love and so was she. You both were scared to marry. You both were scared to have children. Yet you loved each other. When you love someone or something, and you do not live your dreams, you send a part of them here to rot, in the caves of the astral. But isn't she in England? Her mind is here in this hell. Her body is in England. Just like your mind is here and your body is in bed in Cairo. Has she gone crazy or something? You call it that in your world. Really, being crazy just means your dreams end up in the astral and you spend a lot of time here, out of your body. Why am I visiting Helen? Why do you say that I caused this? You caused this together because you both belong together. You both gave up on your dream of love and now she's crazy and you're a lonely, old man. What is your life about? Working? Sitting alone in your room hoping your nephew will take pity on you and invite you for supper? You're an old man who has done nothing with his life because he was afraid. You are just like Helen. You have rotted away the years. Helen is your mirror image. So Ali Mehmet, how does it feel to be an old man who is too lazy to help the people he knows are in terrible trouble? Why do you say I'm lazy? You are lazy because you were afraid of everything. You were lazy to love and now you are lazy to help your friends. Why did you sleep when you should have been helping them? You sleep a lot, don't you, Ali Mehmet? Before Ali Mehmet could answer, the man had turned and swept out of the cave. Despite his wishes, Ali Mehmet was forced to leave Helen, now cackling again, clinging to the walls. They weaved in and out of similar corridors until they came to a sudden halt before a heavy wooden door. It was a door rotten with age, and one attached by ancient iron hinges to the rock wall. The man turned to face the somewhat paralyzed Ali Mehmet. He pointed to the door. "Beyond the door, lies your courage to follow your dreams. The door has always been there, yet you refuse to open it. You ask many questions, yet the answers are there for you." Ali Mehmet stared at the door. This man was right. He was scared of everything. He had been scared to ask Helen to marry him, scared of marriage and children. He was scared to fail at everything. He was now scared of the dark gatekeepers, and he was scared that if he got involved with trying to find Lara, he would fail and she would die a nasty death. "Everyone is afraid of something, Ali Mehmet," the man said kindly. "The thing is, though, we must always do the things we are called to do anyway. We must not let our fear of failing stop us. When we do let our fears stop us, they become demons in the corridors of our minds. They haunt our sleeping moments, taking away our peace. Ali Mehmet walked to the door. He pulled on the rusty ring that would help yank it open. The door was jammed. He yanked again. Still it wouldn't move. He turned to the man and gave a questioning shrug. The man looked at Ali Mehmet and said, "When our fears become our demons, all the doors to courage and freedom remain closed. To open the door you have to get rid of the demons. You know what to do." Ali Mehmet closed his eyes and imagined Helen. In an instant he was with her again, in the cave. She was quiet now, and through the oily hair that hung over her face, huge eyes peered through red-rimmed sockets. "Helen," Ali Mehmet said softly, "I'm sorry I let you go. I'm afraid of many things and I give up on my dream to marry you. Now I know that to find my power, I must be brave and follow my heart even when I'm afraid. Please return to your body in England. Let your mind be well again. You do not belong here. You not be afraid no more. When all this over, I come to find you and we marry. I have loved you all this time and I know you loved me too." As Helen looked at Ali Mehmet, tears filled her eyes. A light from above them both pierced through the darkness and Helen began to transform before the old man's eyes. Her hair seemed to burst into flame as the shining red returned to give it full bloom. Her eyes became the deepest green emeralds he'd always remembered before he went to sleep at night, and her skin returned to the palest English porcelain. She was an image of beauty, the way he'd always held her in his dreams. Ali Mehmet wept before this vision of Helen, and as he did so, she began to age slowly before him until the 40 years had caught up with her. Ali Mehmet gasped. She had lost her youth, but not her beauty. She smiled upon him and said, "I will wait for you and give you strength." With that, she disappeared before his eyes. They were free. Ali Mehmet closed his eyes, focused, and again found himself standing before the man and the door. The door was open. The man waved an arm towards the door. "Go, Ali Mehmet, and do your task. Help Lara, and in doing so, find your own power. There will be many things to fear, but walk past them and you will be free. Remember, the demons are all your thoughts, all of your broken dreams." Ali Mehmet took a breath and smiled wearily at the man. He looked towards the door and slowly, he walked right through it. Lara looked up at the night sky, her heart beating a little too hard. She wasn't thinking clearly. She needed to calm down. She lay down on the cool grass near the Rainbow Bridge. Lady Madonna had left her alone for a while so she could pull herself together. She needed to come up with a plan to get out of here before the dark gatekeepers arrived. As she tried to gather her thoughts, the steady thud of their marching feet traveled the depths of the earth to reach the ground beneath her. Morning. She'd have to think of something before morning. Lara closed her eyes and took a few deep breaths. Sister Abigail had taught her a breathing exercise that would make her feel calm in difficult situations. Taking tests at school didn't compare to being carried off by the dark gatekeepers, but she hoped it would work even now. Lara imagined she could see the air she was breathing and colored it gold. She inhaled the gold air, watching it travel into her lungs, fill them and enter her bloodstream. Then, she exhaled slowly, allowing the breath to carry all the fear out of her body, leaving her clean and peaceful. She did this a few times until she felt completely relaxed. The trick, she remembered Sister Abigail saying, was that when you focused on your breath, your mind couldn't be busy with fear. When you were not thinking about the things that made you scared, your body relaxed and could think clearly again. Lara's heart beat much more slowly now. She smiled and opened her eyes to meet the familiar sight of Orion in the night sky, holding up his bow and aiming for the heavens. There he was, the great hunter Dad had told her so many mysterious stories of Orion. The three stars that made up his belt were mirrored on the ground in the form of the three pyramids. The three pyramids? Lara sat up suddenly, still staring at the sky. She leaned back again. The three pyramids. They were lined up in exactly the same way as the three stars of Orion's belt. Lara's heart started racing again, Only this time it was a good sort of racing. She felt excited. Didn't she see Orion clearly last night when she'd arrived at this place, and didn't the man, just before he'd disappeared back to where they'd come from, look up at the sky? She traveled here via the Great Pyramid. Lara jumped up. Orion's belt was a key to her getting out of here. She didn't know how, yes, she did know how. She ran across the grass away from the Rainbow Bridge and found her way to the meadow in which she'd arrived the previous evening. The rock she and the man had sat upon was positioned almost in the middle of the area of wild grass. She walked over to it. It was a low-lying rock that covered quite a large area of ground. It was rough in places, but smooth in others. She looked at the place she had sat with the man. It was smooth. She ran her hand along it. Yes, smooth from many years of use. She climbed onto the rock and lay herself across it. She didn't feel too comfortable, but she was able to lie and stare up at the belt of three stars and think for a while. They came in here through the Great Pyramid. This place, Rainbow's End, was it another dimension of Earth? This meadow. She sat up carefully on the rock and then hoisted herself up until she was standing, looking out onto the expanse of wild grass. She jumped off the rock and ran to the edge of the grass where the meadow ended. The grass was different here in the meadow. It was wilder outside of it. The grass was thicker and softer somehow, like the grass that people had in their gardens. She ran around the entire meadow. It was pretty huge, and by the time she'd been right around, she was exhausted. She traveled quite far out from the rock in all directions, and when she'd roughly measured the distances, she was sure they were equal on all sides. That was it, she thought. This meadow is on the same spot as the Great Pyramid. Now, Lara declared to the stars, all I have to do is figure out how to get back into that dimension. Nick was tired and frustrated. He'd wandered through what seemed like hundreds of tunnels, and they all looked and smelt exactly the same. They seemed empty and silent. He hadn't met up with any demons yet. Not that he welcomed their company, thank you very much, but this endless emptiness was getting to him. At least let there be different scenery. He leaned against a wall and slid down it to the floor. He'd take a rest for now, before he carried on with this pointless search for direction. What was it Balthazar had said? Nick's eyes were heavy and he struggled to keep them open as he tried to recall the man's words. The roots is within you, Nick, Balthazar was saying. He was standing over Nick. What are you doing here, Balthazar? Am I asleep? Am I dreaming? No one ever sleeps, Nick, they just think they do. The mind travels out of the body to give it a well-earned rest. The body is just a battery that eventually runs out. The mind is like a wire that has a plug to other dimensions. It plugs into the body during the day and makes it work by thinking. Then at night, when the body is tired of thinking, the mind unplugs and goes somewhere else. Why are you here? To remind you that the root is within you. Well, there's no root any place. I just keep wandering down the same old tunnels. Sounds like a human being to me. Try focusing. Oh. Wasn't I doing that? Have you found your root? No. I rest my case. Nick opened his eyes. They felt heavy and he rubbed them to give them some life. Balthazar was gone. Did he fall asleep? Did he dream? Nick remembered Balthazar's words. No. His mind had left his body for a while. Nick rose to his feet and looked up and down the tunnel. Both directions looked the same. He thought for a moment. Focus. Focus on where he was going. Nick tried to picture the ashen forest in his mind. He had never seen the place, but the idea of it was enough. He visualized the image of trees and evil faces, and he began chanting silently, ashen forest over and over again while walking the walls. They were starting to look very different. They were starting to look very sinister. In fact, they were moving forwards. Suddenly Nick felt the sensation of backward movement as the walls picked up speed. Back was his body changing. The movement stopped. Nick took a breath and blinked. He looked down at his body. Oh my word. He was a teenager again. Seth addressed his audience of 9/8. The two empty chairs sent a message to Seth that was a dagger to his back. He'd been betrayed by one of his top men, and he had to do something about it now. He also had to sort out this mess with the Rainfords. Who knows where they were? Seth and the aides hadn't heard a thing from that weasel Abdul-Bakr in the last few hours. He was up to something, and Seth, Dark Lord of the Universe, was not going to let some slimy, bulgy-eyed nobody get the better of him. Why? Seth had ruled this place practically forever, and no one was going to take his place. Listen carefully, Seth started. I want you to arrange a meeting with the Black Sorcerer. Someone gasped, but not one of the nine men said a thing. Did you hear what I said? Seth roared, aggravated by their silence. Yes, Your Grace, the chief aide piped up quickly, you want us to meet with the Black Sorcerer. Seth finished rather loudly. WHWH, where would you like this meeting to take place, Your Grace? The chief aide was sweating. He wiped his brow with a handkerchief and reached into his pocket for his tonic. Where do you think? There isn't a choice. We'll have to go to him. The chief aide took a sip of his tonic, placed it back in his pocket, but before he could step backwards and bow humbly before his Dark Lord, he fell to the ground in a faint.